was found at her home this morning and is believed to have died last night.
But if you run, can you ever escape the truth?
I've seen dead bodies before. I know what I saw.
The Courier.
If she didn't, someone else did.
Begins next Friday at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday the 30th of May. This is Chris Aldridge. Good morning. President Trump has held a meeting to make what he said would be a final determination on whether to agree a deal with Iran to extend their current ceasefire. It's not yet clear if anything was decided. From Washington, our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
In a social media post, Mr. Trump has again said Iran must never have a nuclear weapon and that its stocks of enriched uranium must be handed over and destroyed. He said only the US had the technical ability to facilitate that. He insisted the Strait of Hormuz must be safely reopened to international shipping. He said the US naval blockade in the strait will now be lifted. Ships trapped there for weeks would be, in his words, heading home. Iranian state media has quoted sources saying President Trump's comments are a mixture of truth and falsehood.
According to court documents, emails which showed Andrew Mountbatten Windsor sharing confidential government information were given to Buckingham Palace 6 years ago. They were among an archive of 30,000 emails taken from the account of the businessman Jonathan Rowland, who travelled with the former prince when he was an official trade envoy. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor is under investigation by police on suspicion of misconduct in public office. He has consistently denied wrongdoing. Ben King reports.
The archive of messages from the then Prince Andrew was taken from Jonathan Rowland's personal email account in 2013 and passed to a retail entrepreneur, Kevin Stanford. Documents from a court case about the archive reveal that Mr. Stanford passed it to a senior palace official. Mr. Rowland earlier told the BBC that an email from Mr. Mountbatten Windsor about Iceland was among those taken from his account and subject to legal proceedings. The prince, as trade envoy, requested a confidential briefing from the Treasury on negotiations with the Icelandic government and passed it to Mr. Rowland, suggesting he considered the information before he made his move.
Buckingham Palace said it couldn't comment on an ongoing police inquiry. Social media companies, including Instagram's owner Meta, have agreed to pay an American school district a total of $27 million, or £20 million, to settle its claim that their platforms contributed to a student mental health crisis. Breathitt County in Kentucky is among more than 1,000 school districts across the US that have brought similar legal cases. Here's our North America technology correspondent, Lily Jamali.
Kentucky's Breathitt County School District had been poised to be the first school district to seek compensation from Meta at trial. Breathitt County School District had sued for a total of $60 million from not just Meta, but TikTok, Snap, and YouTube. After settling the cases, it will get just under half that. The companies have denied the allegations and say they take steps to keep young users safe. Meta, Snap, and YouTube said they had resolved the claims amicably. Lawyers for Breathitt County say they will now pursue similar cases brought by 1,200 other school districts across the U.S.
The Attorney General, Lord Hermer, has told the BBC he had no doubt about referring the sentences of three teenage boys related to the rapes of two girls to the Court of Appeal. A judge's decision to spare the boys custody and give them youth rehabilitation orders was heavily criticised by the victims and senior politicians. Three judges at the Court of Appeal will now review that ruling. Speaking to Nick Robinson's Political Thinking podcast, Lord Hermer praised the victims for coming forward.
The bravery of those girls, both putting themselves through the ordeal of a trial, but what is more, when they got those sentences, to carry on campaigning to secure justice.
The UK boss of the airline Wizz Air has advised holidaymakers to arrive 3 hours before flights home from European destinations because of lengthy queues caused by new border checks. The entry-exit system requires travellers from outside the EU to register biometric information when entering many European countries. BBC News has been told that the broadcaster TNT Sports has not replied to a letter sent by the Prime Minister a week ago asking it to make the Champions League final free to air. This afternoon's match between Arsenal and PSG will be the first time since the Champions League was launched in 1992 that supporters have had to pay to watch the final. That's the BBC News. Now a look at the weekend weather with Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thank you and good morning. Well, for Western Scotland today, it's cloudy with outbreaks of showery rain, some of which could turn out to be heavy. There could be a rumble or two of thunder around as well. For Southern and Eastern Scotland, sunny spells at first and then turning cloudier with occasional rain later. For Northern Ireland, it's cloudy, spells of rain through the afternoon, sunny spells later with bands of showers then pushing eastwards. So there is also the risk of some thunder here. But further south, again, it's a pretty lovely day of weather. It's dry and it's mostly fine for Wales, for Northern England, for South West England, for the Midlands and for South East England too. Fine and sunny, largely dry with a small chance of one or two isolated showers and light to gentle southwesterly winds. Still feeling warm, highs of 24 to 28 degrees Celsius for Southern and Eastern England. For the rest of England, 19 to 23 degrees, Wales 18 to 22, and for Scotland and Northern Ireland, cooler, obviously wetter here, 15 to 19 Celsius.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Now for a look at the morning papers, and the Daily Telegraph leads on President Trump's suggestion that he'll lift the US blockade of Iranian shipping. The paper notes it is a likely first step towards a peace deal, and that following the Truth Social post, oil prices fell to a six-week low. The Financial Times strikes a different tone with its headline, Trump makes Iran truce demands. It says the president has reiterated that Tehran must never have a nuclear weapon. Sir Keir Starmer has warned that Vladimir Putin poses a threat to European security, according to the Daily Mirror. The comments came after a Russian drone flew into a block of flats in Romania. The paper's front page shows a picture of the damaged building. The Daily Mail describes a decision to not seek a third trial against two brothers accused of assaulting police officers at Manchester Airport as an affront to justice. It says senior Conservative and Reform UK politicians have described the move as disgraceful and completely wrong. Both men denied assaulting a male officer and two juries were unable to reach verdicts. The Times highlights a link between a rise in cancer cases among women under 50 and poor sleep. Scientists in the US collected data from 19 million people between 2021 and this year. According to the paper, they found that patients with insomnia were three times more likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer. The Guardian says a new test can decide which breast cancer patients need chemotherapy and which don't. According to its report, a global trial suggests millions of women could safely avoid the treatment without increasing the risk of the cancer returning. Sales of condoms in China have fallen sharply, according to the Financial Times, after the government removed a long-running tax exemption as part of efforts to boost the country's birth rate. The report says a leading brand saw its sales drop by 5%. China's birth rate hit a record low last year. That's our look at the papers. More in the Today programme from 7 o'clock. Now, have you heard of the Hawkstone Farmers Choir? They've reached the final of Britain's Got Talent, and we'll hear more of their story at 6:30. First on Radio 4, Claire Baldings with a wonderful group of men in Aberdeenshire for today's Ramblings.
Right, good morning all. Great to see a large crowd here today. Our walk today is through the Fetternear Estate, taking in the Bishop's Palace. We'll then go on, heading towards the shack in Briggy. We'll probably stop there for a coffee, and then cross the shack in Briggy along the unclassified road to the ponds, a nature reserve that's been one time sand quarry, and it's now been transformed into a nature reserve.
It's a misty morning in Aberdeenshire, and we've got a group of maybe 16, 18 men who are all part of the Geary 50 Plus walking group. And Hamish, you got in touch with us, and you're the one who's organising today. This is, as you said, a good turnout.
We usually get around, on average, probably 15, as many as 21, I think, was the record. But if everyone turned up, then we could perhaps have, you know, 30 people. But a lot of them on grandparent duties, and yeah.
We'll try and talk to as many of the group as possible, but if we get going. We've got a trishaw at the front here, which is a bicycle with a seat in the front of it. Graham's going to be doing the cycling. Just let you get your footstep in.
That's so he doesn't jump out.
Yeah. And is it Russell in front there? And Russell, you were a walking member of the group, I guess, for a long time. And and why the trishaw today?
I'm recovering from prostate surgery about 5 weeks ago. So I'm not quite match fit yet. So utilise this for the day to be able to join you all for first part of the walk.
My favourite part of the tri shop.
Did you get a pound every time for that?
Oh, better do a few then, eh?
Walking down a tarmac drive on the Fetternir estate, daffodils right and left, woodland, deep woodland, right and left as well. And if you want to follow us on the map, the grid reference for where we started is NJ 727160. The what three words is landowner, stormed, number. Is this the River Don here?
That's the River Don, yes.
Because it's good and wide and flowing fast.
Mm.
Graham's got into his rhythm on the bike. So do you take this bike for lots of different people all over?
Yeah, anybody that's got mobility issues or disabled, they're just lonely. We try and get them out into the countryside or into the villages. There's a car coming, so we'll just pull over. Oh, he's going on the grass. You're all right.
Oh, he's going
right. so we just try and get people out just to get them back into the community and get their wind in their hair. The charity started in Copenhagen in 2012, and we're nearly in 90 parts of Scotland now.
For you personally, Graham, I mean, obviously what you're doing is giving other people the release and freedom. But do you benefit from it as well? Do you enjoy it?
I really enjoy it because I get out and meet new people. And I've actually got a bad back, so I was ill health retired a few years ago. And because this is an electrically assisted trishaw, I'm able to get out and I'm doing some exercise myself.
Just let you negotiate those ruts.
Yeah.
So you give Russell the smoothest ride. How's it feeling up front?
Yeah, it's fine.
Hamish was saying quite a lot of men in the group have been through the prostate journey. So have you found it a benefit to talk to them?
Yeah, it's been a great benefit. And just a couple of weeks ago,
Can we just pull in? There's a car coming behind us.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, one of the guys phoned me a couple of weeks ago. I was probably about 2 weeks out of surgery and feeling a bit down. I thought one or two things were... lacking a bit, but he reassured me just to have patience and these things take time. Yeah, gave me a lot of reassurance.
So the group as a whole has been, for you, about a lot more than walking?
Oh yeah. It's been that from day one. I mean, we've got no barriers, we've got no secrets. We talk about everything to everybody.
I've dropped back through the group to find Henry, who stands out in his red baseball cap. And everyone, actually, you've got a big long stick with you. Most people have got two walking poles, one or two.
It's always a point of discussion.
Right.
Do you have one or two? And the trouble with only having one is you sort of strengthen one side of your body and not the other. But I found going downhill it works because they have a spring in them. It just saves your knees.
Yes, absolutely. So tell me about your involvement with the group when you joined, when you found out about it.
Well, Russ, you've been talking to already. He sort of helped start the group a good 10 years ago plus now with the help of the NHS. So they did a survey of the 50 plus groups in Aberdeenshire. And found a lot of women in the group, so not many men. And when they asked what they'd done with their men folk, they said, oh, they're at home or they're possibly on the golf course. So this group was set up to kind of get retired men especially out of the house. And it seems to have worked. We've got sort of steady numbers and people move away or decide they're not up to walking anymore and we get new members to replace them. So we seem to be running along quite nicely.
And what have you found the benefits to be?
Well, getting out every week is good. And I lead a few walks. We don't recce them. We're very informal. There's no booking system. If you turn up, you're there. If you're not, you're not. And we have different lengths of walks. So there's a demand recently for shorter walks, sort of 4, 5, 6 miles. Normally we do 8, 9, 10, something like that. So we just adapt as people want them. And we try and start a walk together or something and then split up, or vice versa. They'll start at different points and we'll meet up for lunch or something. But
And you've got a massive choice in Aberdeenshire of where to go.
We have a spreadsheet of about 400 walks.
Really?
Some of them are repeats, but we tried not to repeat in the early days. It's getting harder and harder. But once many of us walk with other groups, and we beg, borrow and steal routes and share them between other groups. So that's a good source of new ones. And the other nice thing about Aberdeenshire is the range of walks. So we've got the hills. You were up Mithar Tap yesterday.
Yeah.
We've got right up to the Cairngorms with four of the highest mountains in Britain, only an hour and a bit away. We've got the coast, 10-mile long beaches, and we've got the bits in between along the Rivers Dee and the River Don. So it's a great variety of walks.
There's a sign up ahead that says Bishop's Palace to the right and Kemnay to the left. Scotland as a whole, but this area in particular, is full of castles, and walking up to what's called the Bishop's Palace, it does look more like a castle. It's got turreted tops, round turrets, and the walls, the exterior walls, still standing complete, but no roof on it, no windows. And the birds are enjoying making their nests in that far wall. So this vast structure, which is now a ruin, is built of granite, but there's a lot of pink granite in there, so it's got a real reddish glow to it.
Yeah, well, Kemnay is famous for pink granite.
So you're going to tell everyone now about the Bishop's Palace?
Right. Come hither. So here we are at the Bishop's, what's known as the Bishop's Palace. Well, this is the second one. The original one was in this area here, and I was just telling the ladies, up until maybe 15, 20 years ago, there was a lecturer from Inverurie originally who taught at Liverpool University. He used to bring students up as a field trip for a couple of weeks in the summer, and they would park in this field here, and you would see them down on their bended knees, beavering away with their trowels, excavating bits and pieces. So this was built between 1211 and 1300 for Bishop Ramsay of Aberdeen as his summer palace. Not a bad little pied de terre, I guess. William Wallace and troops stayed here, 1297, and it says recent excavations in this area, but I haven't seen anybody here for quite some years. Burnt down in 1910, due to a maid putting fire's ashes into a cupboard. Probably not very clever.
But isn't it funny looking up at the ruins and these empty windows of trees growing through them? And you see big old birds going in behind and the sheep in front. And that feeling of the building now being overrun by nature. And how big is the Fetenir estate?
Come on, residents, Kemnay residents, big.
Big. Yeah. Measured in miles rather than acres.
Oh, yes.
The longer the day goes on, the better it gets. Slightly warmer, but still not too hot. And the River Don now down on the right, rushing through. We've walked into a wall of aroma. It's a really strong smell, and it's because there's a load of wild garlic to the right and just down on the edge of the field. That's nice. John has recommended, George, that I come and talk to you.
Talk to me.
Because I know that you worked for... Well, you worked for Grampian, for ITV.
Grampian Television.
Yeah,
there was four of us went there. There's 80 of us. 80 of our staff went in 1988. So...
For the Olympics?
For the Olympics, yeah.
So what was your role?
My role was recording and editing the packages. So we edited up the packages and sent them to London.
Which is why you were so interested in the kit that we use for this. Yes, so Karen's carrying a very small recording device.
Yes.
And a basic microphone on a pole.
Yes.
And that's that recording device is probably as long as my hand.
Yes.
And not an awful lot wider.
Well, in the 80s was the Sarsfield Electronic News Gathering, which Gampion was the first to use it. A lot of people went across the States to find out about it and came back. And it was U-matic tapes, if you remember that.
I remember in the old days in radio having reel-to-reel tapes and cutting it, actually slicing it with a razor blade and sticking things together to edit things.
Yeah, the recordist, let me say, it was about 16 inches by 8 inches. Probably the depth would have been about 12, 14 inches, and very heavy. You were connected up there with an umbilical cord to the camera, so you had to keep up with the cameraman. There was only about 2 metres between you. In our spare time, when we'd time off, our accreditation allowed us to go anywhere. So we could go into any stadium, go to the journalist seats, the soft load you were running there, 100 metres, and Ben Johnson situation. That happened about 6 in the morning.
So obviously you won the 100 metres, and then the drug test came back pretty quickly, which is interesting because, you know, even now it takes a while. So I think they were on to him before. They knew.
Yeah.
And when did you retire?
14 years ago. So things have changed a lot since then.
And we're making our way through a wooden gate as if we're coming out of the estate. I think we are coming out of the estate and towards a sign that says honey for sale.
So the Shark and Briggy tells you 3 things. It tells you it's a bridge, it tells you it shakes, and it also tells you it's little, because the IE on the end tells you it's a little bridge.
Oh,
so,
ahead of me, I can see the men who've got to the banks of the River Don first have sat themselves on a big concrete platform, and the bridge to the left, there's a white suspension bridge.
It was actually built by Harper and Company in 1879. It was the first one. The unique system that Harper's devised was using a wire rope suspension bridge. Now, these bridges were so popular because they were lightweight in construction. One of our group said, when we were speaking about it earlier on, they were the IKEA bridges. And there were about 60 of these bridges built throughout the world, as far as Nepal, the Falklands, South Africa. So it's quite amazing just how far this design went. And then in 1979, there's a raft race, which used to be very popular. Well, people were standing on the bridge watching the raft race, and one of the stays collapsed. So the bridge just collapsed. So the bridge was actually rebuilt the following year. And then in 2005, it was replaced by this bridge, a cable bridge. That's basically the story of the Burn Hervey Bridge, popularly referred to locally as the Shack and Briggy.
We've crossed the River Don, where apparently it's really popular for cold water swimming, for wild swimming. And it's got real good depth to it, but it's very clean water. A peaty brown hue, but the water itself is in good condition. Alec, you're the back marker with your fluorescent jacket on. Yeah. And I've heard from the others this is always your role.
I'm TEC, which stands for Tail End Charlie. So if they see me, they know everybody's in front of me and everybody's well. So I think all the other gentlemen like me being at the back, because they know if they do fall back, there is somebody that'll stay with them. I come for my enjoyment, the open air, because I used to work with, well, it's now Openreach, and I worked there for 43 years. So I've always worked outside, and I prefer being outside. So that's the way I look at it, and I think a lot of the gentlemen do appreciate it.
And when you retired, what did you see as your you know, in the autumn years, what were you wanting to do?
Yeah, my autumn years, I hadn't really decided, but I used to work with Mr. Winterburn. When I retired, he gave me a phone call, and he says, "You're not sitting at home, because you'll just get big and fat. You're coming to the walking group, and you can just join us." So since then, I've been in the walking group for now 3.5 years. I know I'm getting out, fresh air, and the company of all these wonderful gentlemen.
Gosh, look at the river now down on the right, and it's an expanse of maybe as much as 20 metres, do you think? And it's glistening in the sunlight. And it looks so...
idyllic.
Doesn't it? Yeah. We've walked on and up to the edge of a main road where the stone on the side of the path here is really clear in the writing, and with lots of different names like Hull Docks and Kew Bridge and Thames Embankment and Scottish Parliament. Hamish, what does this represent?
Well, this is all the projects that the local quarry have supplied the granite for. They started getting the granite out of here in the mid-1850s, and you know, that represents really the time when Kemney began to grow.
What strikes me looking at the names in here, there are the ones that you might expect. So Aberdeen Art Gallery, Scottish Parliament, Clyde Bridges, Leith Docks. But then it's the, you know, how far this granite travels.
Mm.
To whether it's Hull or London or Liverpool, the Liver Building.
Yeah, I think at the height of the Thames Embankment building, the granite was transported from here along the railway line, and we just come up a bit of the railway line, into Aberdeen Docks, then loaded onto vessels and taken directly up the Thames to the embankment,
yeah,
and just unloaded them. All that's left now at this quarry here is the is manufacturing of concrete blocks and synthetic granite. There is license to reopen this again, but whether they ever do, it's when you consider, yeah, certainly Marshall College in Aberdeen, you know, the granite they took in the refurbisher there came from China.
Oh, did it?
So it's no longer viable.
Back into civilization and into the edge of Kemney, which is a decent-sized town. And where are we headed, Hamish?
Just head up towards that stone with the plaque on it.
So on the stone there is a plaque that says Place of Origin.
Yeah, it's a 25-acre landscape as art project. As we go onto the cairn itself,
uh-huh,
we can see directly down into the quarry.
I see. What was an easy walk has definitely verged towards moderate, because we've climbed up from Kemney and up a steep man-made hill to this monument that is called Place of Origin. And like a snail's shell, the rocks have been organised so that you can twist around into the centre point. So there's one bit of climbing to go, and then we'll be right at the top. Oh. This gives us the view.
That's about 600 feet deep.
That also is.
And that's what Aberdeen is substantially built of, with a grey granite.
So that is what was the Kemney Quarry?
What was the Kemney Quarry.
And now it looks like a mini fjord, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Filled with water. And the rocks to the sides of it, because they've been cut into. Birds swarming out of them, but they've got... features, haven't they?
Yeah, but I mean, 600 below that water level, You know, you've obviously got the cuts and the steps of all the granite that was progressively removed, hidden with the water now.
And at the highest point that we've been for the whole walk, we get the full panorama and the view of Benahee and the different peaks of those hills.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it just takes all whole panorama here up the walls. You know, you can see as far perhaps as Loch Nagar and the up Royal Dee side. You can see there behind you where they've actually split the granite, where they drill holes and then put in wedges and split it apart. That holes were all done by hand. You know, there was no power tools to drill those holes. And it certainly does sparkle in the, you know, in the sunlight.
Yeah, doesn't it? But what a great spot. You can imagine, you know, folks coming up here to celebrate birthdays or to propose or to come up for Hogmanay or...
I think we've all done our proposals around here. Should mention also that next month we've hired a hostel up just south of Braemar. And it's something we started off pre-COVID to go up there to the bunkhouse and just rough it for a few days, taking in the walks around that area.
Which reminds me, Geary, and most people think, oh, that must be spelt G-E-A-R-Y, whatever they think it's spelt, it's not. you'd look at it and you think, do you not say Garioch? No, no. It's Geary. But it means rough area, doesn't it?
Yes.
Rough crowd. Well, you've been a very kind rough crowd.
So we look forward anyway to Muir Cottage. We have a few good, talented bakers or chefs in our midst. So we get a wide variety of food. Three course, four course perhaps.
So you're invited up, if you like.
Yeah. No, I think I'll leave you to it.
Plenty wine.
Yeah, well, okay.
Yeah.
Change your mind.
Sounds great. But honestly, here's to the next, to that enjoyment, but here's to the next walks.
Yeah. Yep.
Power on. It's great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Indeed. Coming.
Yeah. Certainly delighted to have you.
And coming back the second time. After the first one got cancelled because of the snow in January.
Yes, I think we got the best of it.
Ramblings with Claire Balding is produced by Karen Gregor.
Every Sunday afternoon, test yourself with a new collection of quizzes across a wide range of subjects.
Right, let's test you then.
Starting with books.
Hello, I'm Claire Balding and welcome to Bookmarks, the brand new quiz for Britain's most passionate book lovers.
Life is too short to finish a rubbish book.
Then numbers. Join me, Max Fosh, for Your Numbers Up, a brand new quiz show in which you're solving for X and constantly asking why. Plus travel, as Simon Reeve hosts the globe-trotting quiz Around the World in 80 Ways.
Oh,
test yourself with a new summer of quizzing tomorrow afternoon at 4:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
Now on Radio 4, it's Farming Today this week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. In this week's programme, problems with pigs.
Prices and market returns are well below the cost of production. This really is a dire situation.
What record-breaking heat means for cows.
A cow will drink sort of 100 to 125 litres a day, but once the temperature gets above 25 degrees, you can easily double that.
And the power of music.
Even last night, I was talking with some of the choir members and they were saying that what they had shared with the choir, even the last few days, they'd never told their best friend.
More on that later. First, a relic of a world long before sat-nav or even A to Zs. The black and white cast iron finger posts you can spot on lanes and junctions across the country. Now often ignored, many are in a poor state of repair and are disappearing from our rural landscape. Well, that's why the Northumberland branch of CPRE, the Campaign to Protect Rural England, is running a course this summer to teach people how to restore them, as Jo Lonsdale reports.
Morning. I'm David Gosling and we're here this morning in Matfern Village Hall. The plan is to go out on site, so the hard work of getting the old rusty components apart and then cleaning the posts back to bare metal.
How did you get interested in finger posts?
Wasn't technically interested in them, but my wife was a parish councillor. And as wives do, they see a job that needs doing. A parish council said, well, we've got an old finger post here, we'd like it restored. And my wife said, David will do it. So I got the job of doing it. I was volunteered to do the one in the village where I live, which is Lanercost in Cumbria.
So are they all different in different parts of the country?
They certainly are. All local authorities were, this is in the early 1900s, were using different foundries who all wanted to put their own stamp on things. The embellishments on the top, the finials, are the things that usually delineate which part of the country you're in. And people just seem to like them. And people like history and they like to maintain things. Right, first warning sign is one of these. And that needs to be roughly just beyond where that bloke is with the dog.
So we've come out into the village of Stamfordham, where there's a finger post which really is in dire need of restoration, and they're going to begin taking it down.
Yeah, my name's Steve Elliott. I'm a mole catcher from Alnwick, and I just thought this would be another string to my bow. That can be something to do when the weather's inclement for catching moles. I've seen the odd one west of Alnwick, but since you're signing for the course, you notice, I mean, we're on the way home last night, I drove through Mitford, which I've driven through about 1,000 times. I noticed one on the bridge that I'd never noticed before.
I'm Andrea De Monte, and I'm doing the course because, I work in conservation, so I'm trying to get a better understanding and some practical skills in terms of what entails restoring these signs.
So the course was the idea of Northumberland CPRE. Annie Lloyd from the charity is here.
These are iconic pieces of wayside heritage. I think there's a huge amount of nostalgia for them. In fact, people say that until one or two are restored and they're aware of this, they don't realise that they've been driving past them and walking past them and cycling past them without seeing them. They're starting to notice heritage features and what it is to them that makes a place feel really special and a locality feel truly distinctive.
Annie Lloyd there from Northumberland CPRE. Independent UK pig farmers face an uncertain future. That's according to the National Pig Association, which this week called for long-term commitments from retailers, processors and the food service sector. Well, this comes 2 weeks after the supermarket Morrisons said it will stop buying pigs from some of its farmers because of an oversupply of pig meat, blaming the challenging economic climate. Well, speaking to us at the time, the editor of Pig World, Alistair Driver, said the problem's widespread.
In response to what was a relatively good time, some of the bigger companies have expanded herds, put more sows down. That was compounded in the autumn by one of the big factories had a couple of weeks maintenance. That created a bit of a backlog on farms. Demand generally, it's been flat. The demand just hasn't been there. Pigs have built up gradually on farms. Some people worse affected than others, depending on their supply chains. Allied with it, I'm afraid, we've seen a downturn in European prices. That has put not necessarily import pressure. It's not necessarily that more is being imported to displace it, but it's put price pressure on. So the price has been falling. Add into that mix, you've got the war in the Middle East. That's starting to push up costs.
Scottish pig farmers say they have been disproportionately hit compared with the rest of the UK and that a tenth of the national herd has been lost, that is, culled and not sold for meat. The National Farmers Union Scotland is now calling for immediate help from the Scottish Government as the industry battles an oversupply which, combined with an increase in production costs and lower supermarket prices, is threatening their businesses. BBC Scotland's Laurie Carnican reports.
Save our bacon is the message coming from Gregor Christie, who, alongside his brother Rory, runs a dairy and pig farming business in Dumfries and Galloway. Their grandfather began pig farming in 1954, but Gregor says the financial pressures facing the industry are the most difficult he's ever experienced.
It's very difficult. You know, the costs are still there. We're still having to buy food. There's repairs. The staff need their salaries at the end of the month. For the first quarter of our financial year, which at the end of March, we were 70,000 quid down in income. And for a small pig unit, it cannot go on indefinitely, that's for sure.
There's an abundance of pork in the European markets due to the presence of African swine fever in Spain. It means fewer exports and cheaper imports. This has caused a significant and sustained drop in pig prices, with processing plants facing a backlog of animals waiting to be slaughtered. The result is supply exceeding demand, and farmers are faced with producing pork at a loss. NFU Scotland President Andrew Conan said that the industry is now under unsustainable pressure.
Within the pig sector, we are now facing prices and market returns which are well below the cost of production. And at the moment, the financial situation for pig producers in Scotland is actually industry and business threatening. This really is a dire situation. It's unsustainable.
The union claims 10% of the country's sow herds have been lost since the start of the year. And Alistair Lane is one of those who've chosen to leave the industry. Mr Lane has spent the last 20 years producing pork from his farm near Lockerbie, but says he's been forced to make the devastating decision due to constant uncertainty.
Financially, it just doesn't really make sense to keep investing into something that doesn't have the security going forward. There's just too much uncertainty. It is a wrenching decision, but I feel, you know, potentially a brave one too, a sensible one.
NFU Scotland say a typical 500 sow unit is facing losses of up to £500,000. Mr Conan is calling on the Scottish Government for immediate help and says consumers can also support the industry. A Scottish Government spokesperson said they have worked with the UK Government and other devolved administrations on supply chain fairness regulations designed to improve and create greater fairness in the agricultural supply chain, which enables producers to raise concerns with the supply chain adjudicator if they feel they have been treated unfairly. Meanwhile, back on the farm, Gregor Christie says action is needed now.
It is a case of save our bacon. The pig industry is unsupported, is now at breaking point.
Farmer Gregor Christie there. Now, as you may have noticed, it's been a record-breakingly hot week across much, though not all, of the UK. And that has brought problems with crops struggling and livestock at risk of overheating. Well, let's look at the crops first. This hot spell comes on the heels of one of the driest Aprils on record. And farmers in the east of England warn they'll have to start reviewing the way they plant crops. Heather Oldfield is county chair for the National Farmers Union in South Lincolnshire. And her beans, barley and wheat fields are all suffering because of the weather, as she showed our reporter Bob Huckenhall.
So we're in your winter wheat field now, and you're not happy with the condition, are you, of the crop?
Not as it stands at the moment, Bob. So it's looking pretty clean, but the crop just looks stressed, and I think that's the story across the southern county and down the east of England. So last year, between the 1st of March and present day, we had 44.5 mils of rain. This year, between the same period, we've had 27.9, so that's nearly half of the rainfall. And then you put that in with increased costs of inputs, so fertiliser and diesel, and then you put that together with a reduction in prices for winter wheat, we're probably on for a deficit of about £20 a tonne, is what the weather's going to cost us at the moment. Last year, the drought that we had then cost us about £11 to £12 a tonne, so it's not looking very clever at the moment.
And you've got spring barley in the field next door, and it looks very patchy, doesn't it?
It's really patchy, and that's been drilled for a fair few weeks now as well. It's just moisture. There isn't the moisture there for the seed to germinate. We drilled with a direct drill, which means that it doesn't disturb the soil too much to try and consolidate that moisture. And we really put the seed as far down in the soil as we could to try and hit moisture, but it's not made much of a difference.
How do you see the future then if this weather pattern continues?
We're seriously considering whether we can grow spring crops. You want to drill a crop to know that you're going to get something back and you're going to at least break even. But if looking across the field at the moment, I don't think we will. We have to go more to winter cropping. But then we've got the issue that we've had for the last few years, that when you get to October time, that's when it starts to rain. And that's when, particularly here where we're on heavy clay, it becomes too soft, the ground, to be able to travel with equipment, and then you can't drill.
So there'll be more work done in the winter, you think?
Well, potentially in the autumn, but the problem that you have is we use spring cropping to widen our rotations, to improve soil health, for the environment, and we also use those spring crops to break up pests and diseases as well, and spread your risk.
Are you and other farmers going to look at different crops that perhaps you could grow that maybe don't need as much water?
Farmers, we're very innovative, but looking at anything new requires investment. And there isn't that there at the moment. There's not flex in the system to be able to do that, which is why people are looking to diversify into other things.
Arable farmer Heather Oldfield. Extreme heat means extra concerns for livestock farmers too. The Irish government has issued guidance advising not to transport animals in the hottest part of the day, and farmers and vets will be looking out for symptoms of heat stress. Well, Richard Park has a herd of 140 organic dairy cows just to the south of Kendal in Cumbria. He's been actively future-proofing his farm to deal with heat waves for some time now. Kaz Graham's been to meet him.
Just up at the top of the hill here, we've got your herd of dairy cows. It looks absolutely idyllic, like a classic sort of pastoral English scene. Black and white, brown and white. Tell me what we're looking at.
They're a mixture of breeds. So we've got some Holsteins, we've got some Viking Reds, we've got some Montbelliards, and we've got some Jerseys. A real licorice all sorts.
Yeah, and on a baking hot day like today, we're at the right place for these cows, because this is one of your troughs here?
It is. This is one of our water troughs that we have in every field, every paddock. We can hear the water running in there. And the trough is full, so that's good. That's what we want to see. So what we've got here is a trough with a special valve on. It's a fast flow valve, so it fills the trough very quickly. And then we have a tank near the farm, and that holds enough water for 2 days. And we have a big 50mm pipe that goes underground and feeds all these troughs and a pump, so it's all independent. It just makes sure that the cows always have water in front of them, because a cow will drink sort of 100 to 125 litres a day, but once the temperature gets above 25 degrees, you can easily double that.
Double that.
A cow is an animal whose ideal temperature is probably around about 5 degrees. She has a big rumen that she uses to digest this grass that we've just been walking through, and that generates a lot of heat. What is it now? Probably around about 28 degrees, or past that sort of point of comfort for them, really.
Yeah, they're panting, actually, aren't they?
They are, yeah, they're hot. Sometimes, you know, depending on which paddock they're in, you'll see them all sat on top of the hill, obviously catching a little bit of breeze. This field that we're in, it is on a little hill, but we also have these trees and a big hedge over here.
Yeah, and you actively keep these hedges like this so that they can provide shade.
We do. It's something that we started doing a number of years ago, is allowing the hedges to grow a lot taller for this very reason, amongst others. And we've also, because our fields are split up into different blocks, sometimes they can be in a paddock that doesn't have any hedges or might only have one at one boundary. So what we have started to do this year is put in a agroforestry system. So we've got a line of trees, and then at either side we've got a line of shrubs that in a few years will grow up and provide the same benefits that we've got on this boundary of this field.
How does this heat affect the milk that comes out of these cows?
Well, it can lower the milk production just because the cow is a bit more uncomfortable and they probably don't eat as much. But for us, our cows all calve in the autumn. So at this time of year, they're in what we call late lactation. So they're reaching the point where they will stop being milked for a couple of months. So they're actually not giving a great deal of milk. So it doesn't really affect us in that sense.
And this grass that we're standing in, this long grass, I mean, it's not just important as feed for now. It's important as winter fodder as well. You cut it at this time of year and then store it for the winter as silage. Lots and lots of farmers out silaging at the moment. I passed a couple just driving here this morning. What kind of impact will this real extreme heat have on this year's silage?
As a dairy farmer, I take 4 to 5 cuts of silage. So we've taken our first cut, and then we'll be taking a subsequent cut every 5 to 6 weeks.
And that means that you cut it and then you let it grow again?
Yes.
And then you cut it again?
Yes.
Just like mowing your lawn in a way, but storing that grass as feed for the winter?
Exactly that.
So what impact does this heat have on the silage that you're cutting?
Normally in Cumbria, when you're making silage, you're watching the weather forecast for rain, but obviously that's not a problem at the moment. But you would probably not spread it out to dry. It is actually possible to get it too dry. And to make silage, you're not making hay, so you don't want it too dry. So it's sort of getting that balance.
Well, that's interesting, because one of our listeners actually emailed us and said, can grass ever be too dry to make silage?
It probably can. The problem if it's too dry is because to make silage you need to compact it down and get all the air out, and if it's too dry it's really difficult to do that.
And can it be that if you cut a grass for silage and it's really, really hot, how does that impact the further growth afterwards? I've passed quite a few fields over the last couple of days that look really yellow after they've been silaged.
They do look yellow just at the moment, don't they? Yeah, but there is actually quite a bit of moisture in the ground and there's actually rain forecast next week. So this is something you won't hear very often, but as a farmer, I'm very happy with the way the weather is.
Hello, we've got a 716 who is a beautiful chestnut colour with beautiful eyes and eyelashes. She's just come to say hello.
With those beautiful eyes and eyelashes, I'm guessing she'll have a little bit of Jersey in her.
Richard Park with Kaz there. Now, water is a major topic of conversation amongst farmers at the moment because, as Heather Oldfield in Lincolnshire mentioned earlier, it is in short supply. Environment Agency figures show that rainfall across England last month was 38% of the long-term average. South Essex got 2 millimetres. That's just 5% of the average. Now, rain is forecast, but for those who irrigate their crops over the summer with water taken out of rivers or aquifers, it's called abstraction, what are the prospects? Stephen Moncaster is a water management specialist with Norfolk Environment Food and Farming.
Farmers, particularly in the east of England, but also in the Midlands, grow a large volume of irrigated crops, so potatoes, salads, other crops that require water during the summer. That water is pumped out of the ground from aquifers or from rivers or from reservoirs, and all water which is abstracted in that way is licensed by the Environment Agency.
Is it likely, do you think, that this year, because we haven't had that much rain recently, farmers will be limited on what they're allowed to take?
There was quite a lot of rainfall over the winter period that's just passed, topping up the natural systems on which we rely more or less back to normal. And although some people will undoubtedly go short, I think most people will be okay unless the dry weather conditions persist.
What does a farmer do then when they've been thinking, well, I'll be taking this amount of water in abstraction and suddenly that is reduced? At that point, what are your options?
For some, it means the end of their business in terms of irrigated agriculture and they have to go and find something else to do. Other people adapt their businesses by building winter storage reservoirs, so taking water from rivers in the winter when it's available. Other people move from where there isn't water to where there is, so there's kind of a shift in the pattern of agriculture.
You work with a group of growers and farmers in the east of England. What have you changed about what they do to try and improve their water management?
We have about 150 farmers. They're organised by catchment. We look at the total volume of abstraction from groundwater and surface water in the catchment. We compare that to the targets that the agency has for flows and other things. And for those that do have issues, we're then able to work with them on options. So the new winter storage reservoirs, new licences.
We haven't really, either as normal consumers or as farmers, had to really think hard about water in this country for many, many, many years. Is that going to have to change?
It does have to change. The Environment Agency are dealing with a legacy abstraction system that was put in place in the 1960s. It's left many of our catchments over-abstracted and over-licensed, and they are going through a 10-year process of addressing that issue. At the end of it, abstraction and catchments will be sustainable. What that means is there'll be lots of people who currently have licences that will have licences that are either cut or removed entirely. And that's going to be a big deal for a lot of people.
Steve Moncaster. Right, let's end today with some music. The Hoxton Farmers Choir singing Bastille's Pompeii on Britain's Got Talent. And that performance got them through to tonight's final. The choir is made up of farmers and others working in agriculture. It was originally set up as part of an advertising campaign, but it has since been using its growing fame to talk about mental health in farming. Katrina Shell is a member of the choir. She's usually on the family farm in Northumberland. Tonight, she'll be on stage.
My nerves are a bit shattered, a bit frayed. I think I'm okay at the moment, but later on today, I think we're going to be needing a few deep breaths. Let's put it that way.
It was a pretty amazing experience just watching the semi-final, which you won. What was it like singing?
It was honestly one of the best things I've ever done in my life. Bar having my family, I didn't even know I wanted to be on stage. And now I feel like I quite fancy doing it again. The thing is, I'm not there by myself. I'm with 32 other amazing people that are now truly classed as close friends. So I think to experience it with them is, that's the bit for me that I absolutely love. I wouldn't want to do it by myself.
You've got another weekend off the farm for the final. Just on a purely practical level, how are you all finding it, getting people to cover for you at home?
Yeah, so my husband, he is the main farmer, I suppose. He day in, day out, that's what he does full time. I, as many women in agriculture know, have to juggle quite a lot. So I have to jump in and feed, and during hay time, I have to go and help bale or row up or harvest. I might have to jump on the, go and lead off the combine or provide teas. We've also got three children, and we diversified on the farm as well. So I've got a camping and glamping site. So it is a huge juggle, I have to say, but we just had to make it work.
What are you going to sing tonight?
I would love to tell you, but I can't.
Oh, it's a secret.
It's a secret, yeah. But it's incredible. Mm. Never been done before. The lyrics really, really hit home, and they mean so much to us.
Can't wait to see it. This choir has had this massive impact way beyond the singing. Have you been surprised by the reaction you've had?
Hugely surprised. We knew that it was something special. So we did the beer adverts and things, and they were a bit of a laugh, and we all had good fun. And then it soon became apparent that this is like therapy for us, just in the 33 of us. We were telling things that we wouldn't share with other people. And then we thought, actually, if we can feel like that, maybe we can do that for other people as well. And it sort of evolved from there. It was a bit of a snowball effect, really. And then we put a few things online, and the comments we received back were so humbling. We soon realized that if we can make this feeling sort of expand and grow to the wider audience and represent British agriculture and the rural communities and mental health within that, then that surely we've got to do something about that.
It's a very positive way as well, isn't it, of shining a light on something which is really difficult and really tricky for many people who work in agriculture.
We are shining a light on it, and we just want to push the message that it is okay not to be okay, and there's a stigma attached to struggling. And especially in old-fashioned farming, it's not talked about a lot. And we want to say, actually, you'll be surprised. Once you start opening up, you'll be surprised how many people actually are struggling or have struggled. Even last night, I was talking with some of the choir members, and they were saying that actually what they had shared with the choir, even the last few days, they'd never told their best friends. To be able to feel so privileged that they have chosen me or us to talk to, that is a really humbling experience. Yeah, it's just incredible.
Katrina Shell there from the Hawkston Farmers Choir. Good luck to them tonight. That's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Heather Simons. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
Thanks, Charlotte. Now let's get a weekend weather picture with Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thanks, Chris. Good morning. Well, it's a bit of a north-south split going on today across the UK. Still very warm across parts of the south. England and Wales looking largely dry, but there is rain on its way across Scotland and Northern Ireland. That's been pushing in from the west so far this morning. Let's start across western Scotland then. For the rest of the day, it's cloudy with spells of showery rain. Could be a rumble or two of thunder in some of those showers a bit later on through the afternoon. For southern and for eastern Scotland, well, we are seeing some early sunny spells. It is quickly going to cloud over, I think, and there'll be some spells of rain a bit later on through the day. The rain not quite here yet. For Northern Ireland, then already some rain pushing in from the west. Through the afternoon behind the weather front, there should be some sunny spells developing, but some bands of showers as well moving eastwards. And once more, there could be some thunderstorms embedded in some of those showers. But let's come further south across England and Wales. For many parts of Wales, northern England, southwest England, it's dry. It's mostly fine today, but it will start to cloud over a little from the west as we head through the afternoon. But across the Midlands, southeast England, East Anglia, we'll keep the sunshine pretty much all day. Just the small chance of one or two isolated showers, mid-level showers, so big drops that won't last for too long as we head through the late morning, first part of the afternoon. For most of us today, light to gentle southwesterly winds. For much of England, it's 19 to 23 degrees. degrees Celsius, Wales 18 to 22. For parts of central, southern and eastern England, we could get as high as 27 to 28 degrees Celsius. And for Scotland and Northern Ireland, we're talking about 15 to 19 degrees. Now, tonight, those weather fronts continue to spread southwards and eastwards, staying wet towards the north, but across many parts of England, again, still, it's largely dry, but it will turn quite cloudy. Lows tonight are 10 to 14 Celsius, a cooler feeling day tomorrow with showers for all.
Thanks, Elizabeth. We'll meet the musician and composer Tom Fletcher later this morning, talking about McFly and Paddington. That's on Saturday Live from 9 o'clock.
When the situation is all too familiar, when the characters are a bit too close to home, when you just can't help but laugh at it all.
Your mum does that all the time.
My mum? You do that all the time.
I don't. Do I? Maybe. Do I?
Nothing brings us together like great TV. And a TV licence covers you to watch all TV channels, plus BBC iPlayer, so you can keep laughing along with your favourite sitcoms. It also funds everything you love from the BBC, including Radio 4. Find out more at tvl.co.uk.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 30th of May. Good morning. This is Today with Simon Jack and Justin Webb.
The headlines this morning. Court documents say Buckingham Palace was handed emails 6 years ago that showed Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor was sharing confidential government information while a trade envoy. There's been no announcement from President Trump after a White House meeting to decide whether to sign off a deal with Iran. The US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had this to say overnight.
He's only going to get a great deal. I know we'll get a great deal. That's not any deal, that's a great deal.
After 8, we'll examine just how far apart the US and Iran remain.
And also in today's programme.
We are faced with a succession of two aggressive storms.
Are you absolutely certain?
D-Day will be calm and sunny. I couldn't disagree with that more.
The story behind the meteorologist central to the planning of the D-Day invasions has been turned into a film. We'll be talking to David Hay, the man behind the original telling of Pressure.
And good morning from Mike Williams with your Saturday Sport on Champions League final day. Arsenal face Paris Saint-Germain in Budapest later. Knowing a win will see them crowned European champions for the first time in their history. Before that, it's Rugby League's big day out at Wembley. We will look ahead to both the men's and women's Challenge Cup finals.
The BBC News read this morning by Chris Aldridge.
According to court documents, emails which showed Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor sharing confidential government information were given to Buckingham Palace 6 years ago. They're among an archive of 30,000 emails taken from the account of the businessman Jonathan Rowland, who travelled with the former prince when he was an official trade envoy. Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor is under investigation by police on suspicion of misconduct in public office relating to the alleged sharing of confidential material. He's consistently denied wrongdoing. Ben King reports.
The archive of messages from the then Prince Andrew was taken from Jonathan Rowland's personal email account in 2013. And passed to a retail entrepreneur, Kevin Stanford. Documents from a court case about the archive reveal that Mr. Stanford passed it to a senior palace official in 2020. Mr. Rowland earlier told the BBC that an email from Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor about Iceland was among those taken from his account and subject to legal proceedings. The prince, as trade envoy, requested a confidential briefing from the Treasury on negotiations with the Icelandic government and passed it to Mr. Rowland, suggesting he considered the information before he made his move. The palace said it couldn't comment on an ongoing police inquiry.
President Trump has held a meeting to make what he said would be a final determination on whether to agree a deal with Iran to extend their current ceasefire. It's not yet clear if anything was decided. A White House official said the president would only make a deal that was good for America. A senior Iranian official has said an agreement is close, but not yet approved. From Washington, our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
In a social media post, Mr. Trump has again said Iran must never have a nuclear weapon and that its stocks of enriched uranium must be handed over and destroyed. He said only the US had the technical ability to facilitate that. He insisted the Strait of Hormuz must be safely reopened to international shipping. He said the US naval blockade in the strait will now be lifted. Ships trapped there for weeks would be, in his words, heading home. Was this a promise to lift the US blockade without an agreement with Iran? It's not clear. Iranian state media has quoted sources saying President Trump's comments are a mixture of truth and falsehood, an attempt to portray a fabricated victory. The country's foreign affairs spokesman said negotiations were focused on ending the war, not resolving the nuclear issues.
Social media companies, including Instagram's owner Meta, have agreed to pay an American school district a total of $27 million, or £20 million, to settle a claim that their platforms contributed to a student mental health crisis. Breathitt County in Kentucky is among more than 1,000 school districts across the US that have brought similar legal cases. Here's our North America technology correspondent, Lily Jamali.
Kentucky's Breathitt County School District had been poised to be the first school district to seek compensation from Meta at trial. Sources familiar with the deal, which was announced last week, say Meta paid $9 million to settle the case. They were the last company planning to contest the school district's allegations that social media apps created a mental health crisis. Breathitt County School District had sued for a total of $60 million from not just Meta, but TikTok, Snap, and YouTube. After settling the cases, it will get just under half that. The companies have denied the allegations and say they take steps to keep young users safe. Meta, Snap, and YouTube said they had resolved the claims amicably. Lawyers for Breathitt County say they will now pursue similar cases brought by 1,200 other school districts across the U.S.
The Attorney General, Lord Hermer, has told the BBC he had no doubt about referring the sentences of three teenage boys, related to the rapes of two girls, to the Court of Appeal. A judge's decision to spare the boys custody and give them youth rehabilitation orders was heavily criticised by the victims and senior politicians. Three judges at the Court of Appeal will now review that ruling. Speaking to Nick Robinson's Political Thinking podcast, Lord Hermer praised the victims for coming forward.
The bravery of those girls, both putting themselves through the ordeal of a trial, but what is more, when they got those sentences, to carry on campaigning to secure justice.
The UK boss of the airline Wizz Air has advised holidaymakers to arrive 3 hours before flights home from European destinations because of lengthy queues caused by new border checks. The entry-exit system requires travellers from outside the EU to register biometric information when entering many European countries. This has to be verified when they leave. A European Commission spokesman said the system was working well at almost all border crossing points. But Wizz Air's chief executive, Yvonne Monaghan, told BBC News that passengers should expect delays at the start and end of their holidays.
It's when you land in the destination airport, there might be queues, so you should bring a portable charger or water. So when you're returning to the UK, because there is another passport check, and that's where we see that people have experienced longer waiting times than anticipated.
Councils in England have criticised plans to scrap the independent watchdog that deals with concerns about health and care services, warning the move could create confusion and weaken accountability. The Department of Health and Social Care says abolishing Health Watch England will bring patients' views closer to decision makers, giving people's experiences a more direct influence on services. Here's our social affairs editor, Alison Holt.
The Local Government Association says it's concerned by the lack of a plan for an alternative to Health Watch, which currently challenges the NHS and providers of care services in the community when patients or the public highlight problems. Without an independent body to replace it, the LGA says the organisations will be left to mark their own homework. Proposals in the NHS Modernisation Bill transfer the watchdog's responsibilities to the health service and councils, so they'd have to respond to feedback about their own services. The LGA describes this as a significant step back in accountability. It warns it will be a fragmented system and has asked for urgent clarity on how people using services will be given a voice and how that will be funded.
BBC News has been told that the broadcaster TNT Sports has not replied to a letter sent by the Prime Minister a week ago asking it to make the Champions League final free to air. This afternoon's match between Arsenal and PSG will be the first time since the Champions League was launched in 1992 that supporters have had to pay to watch the final. Arsenal fans have travelled in their thousands to Budapest for the game, which will also be screened at a sold-out Emirates Stadium in North London. 6 days after lifting the Premier League trophy, the Arsenal manager, Mikel Arteta, says his team are ready to win the Champions League for the first time.
The preparation has been really, really good, really focused, really positive. We are here because we have earned the right to be here in the manner that we have played and perform in the competition. And tomorrow on that field, we're going to have to earn the right to go and win the trophy.
That was Arsenal's Mikel Arteta.
Thank you, Chris. 9 minutes past seven. As you were hearing in the headlines, emails which showed Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor sharing confidential government information were given to Buckingham Palace 6 years ago, the BBC has learned. They were among an archive of 30,000 other emails taken from the account of Jonathan Rowland, a controversial businessman who travelled the world with Andrew when he was an official trade envoy. Ben King is our business reporter and has the story. What's emerged today?
That's right, Simon. This is the story of an archive of around 30,000 emails that were taken from the personal account of Jonathan Rowland, a businessman, in 2013. Now, he was a close associate of Prince Andrew, as he was then, and some of these emails refer to his business dealings with the former prince. Now, there have been quite a few court cases about these documents because they were passed to another businessman called Kevin Stanford, the retailer who was the majority owner of All Saints at one time. And he'd had a long-running legal dispute with the Rowlands. Now, if you read the judgments in those cases, they say that in 2020, Kevin Stanford passed the emails to the Lord Chamberlain, who is the most senior member of the royal household.
And do we know what's in the emails?
Well, Jonathan Rowland didn't answer our queries about these emails, but we have messaged him before about one particular email chain which emerged in a newspaper in February. And that chain was sent in 2010, and it shows Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, who was then, of course, the UK's official trade envoy, asking for a confidential briefing from the Treasury about negotiations with Iceland about compensation for depositors in Icelandic banks. And he invites Rowland to consider this information before he, quote, makes his move. Now, Rowland told us that this email was one that was taken from him and was subject to legal proceedings, which indicates that it was very likely part of that archive that we now know was shared with the palace. And that suggests that the palace could have known about that email back in 2020. That was a few months after Andrew stepped down as a working royal following his interview on Newsnight. And we also know that a journalist was given access to some of these emails, and they're likely to have been the source of quite a few other newspaper stories about Andrew as well.
And do we have a response from the palace?
Well, we asked the palace if they knew about this email and if they did what they did with that information, but they said they couldn't comment on an ongoing police inquiry. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor was, of course, arrested in February on suspicion of misconduct in a public office. And we asked Thames Valley Police, who's leading the investigation, if they had access to the archive. And they said they're aware of the allegations circulating in the public domain, and they encourage anyone with relevant information to get in touch. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor didn't reply to our questions, but he has previously denied wrongdoing and getting any personal gain from his role as a trade envoy.
Ben, thank you. Ben King there, our business reporter.
12 minutes past seven. There is still no deal to extend the US-Iran ceasefire. Let's talk to Amir Nader, our Middle East correspondent, who's talking to us this morning from Jerusalem. And let's start, Amir, not exactly where you are, but in broad terms, what we think is happening. And obviously that is particularly with regard to Washington and particularly with regard to what Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, or War, as he styles it, has been saying.
Well, we had this post from President Trump last night saying he was going into the Situation Room to make a final determination on this deal, but he didn't, and we have no idea when that determination might come. He asserted a number of red lines at the time, saying Iran won't have a nuclear weapon, that the Strait of Hormuz will be open but without tolls imposed on it, and the US will take part in destroying any Iranian nuclear material, that highly enriched uranium. Iran, we've just been hearing, has been giving an opposite picture. It's saying that in this initial period of the deal, there won't be any commitments on anything nuclear. It wants to jointly administer the Strait of Hormuz with Oman, not imposing tolls, but imposing fees for some services. And then there is still this dispute about the frozen assets, the Iranian frozen assets around the world, which it wants to unlock. But President Trump last night saying there won't be any deal on the money. Then you had these comments from Pete Hegseth, as you mentioned, the defense secretary, saying that the US is capable and willing to restart the fighting, saying that the US has enough munitions. There has been some questions around how much munitions have been depleted during the peak of the war. And this is coming at the end of really the worst week of violence between the two sides since the ceasefire deal came into effect. You've had the US striking Iran a number of times. And in retaliation, we've seen Iran striking out in the Gulf. And we're just learning that the Iranians fired a ballistic missile, according to the US, at a base in Kuwait. And we're learning that, according to Bloomberg, a number of US servicemen were injured. And Pete Hegseth's comments clearly just going to show that both sides are wanting to really reassert their aggressive posturing in this whole ceasefire negotiation process.
And there's another complication, isn't there, which is closer to where you are, which is that the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon is carrying on.
Expanding, indeed. Yesterday you had Prime Minister Netanyahu saying that his ground forces have crossed the Litani River, which is a sort of strategic natural boundary around 30 kilometres deep into southern Lebanon. We know from the past few days Hezbollah have said they've been clashing with Israeli forces on the ground in that area. You'll remember that the Israeli military is given an evacuation order, an order to all of the residents of Lebanon in the south of the country to leave. That's caused huge panic and adding to the more than 1 million Lebanese people who are displaced in the country. You had the Lebanese authorities yesterday saying 31 Lebanese people were killed in Israeli attacks, including 11 in Tyre. And then just this morning, the Israeli military saying that a number of projectiles coming from Lebanon were intercepted in northern Israel, but it looks like there was one direct hit in the city of Kiryat Shemona in the north, although you haven't had any injuries reported. And yesterday you had these talks at the Pentagon between the Lebanese and Israeli delegations looking at ways to progress this sort of ceasefire process between the two countries. And there just does seem to be a fundamental disagreement, really, currently between the two sides, where you have Israel saying that its attacks are helping the Lebanese government dismantle and disarm Hezbollah, whereas the Lebanese president yesterday saying the opposite, that they need a ceasefire in order to begin with this complex topic of disarming Hezbollah.
Amir Nader in Jerusalem. Thank you.
7:15. As the rain came pouring down this winter, and it was a wet one, England had 42% more than average from December to February, we consoled ourselves with the idea that we would have plenty of water for our hotter, drier summers that we now get. And yet, of course, when the recent heatwave struck, we saw misery for thousands of customers of South East Water in Kent who have had no or intermittent water supplies for several days now. The latest from the company says 6,500 customers in Whitstable have had drinking water restored, but several hundred are still without. We can talk to Sarah, who's got who's a hair salon owner in Whitstable. Good morning to you, Sarah. What happens this morning when you turn on the taps?
Well, hopefully we're going to have water again like we did yesterday. But we're very cautious because we have been made aware that it could be intermittent or very low pressure.
OK. And what impact has that had both on you personally and on the business?
Well, on the business, dramatically, because obviously Thursday we wasn't able to open at all. We had to cancel and reschedule all clients, and we were all very busy considering there was five of us in. Yesterday we opened, but we opened with limited availability because we just wasn't 100% sure if we would be able to commence with full service.
I don't suppose it's the kind of thing you can use the bottled water that they sometimes deliver to households as a replacement. You've got a real problem.
We do, most definitely. I mean, we do have plenty of bottled water in the salon, so if need be, we could use that. But when we're trying to remove colour, it's not the easiest thing. We have to be really careful, and our clients, you know, deserve the best service that we can provide.
Okay. And have they apologised? What's the communication with the company been like?
Nothing, literally. It's just a global message. They're working on it. As far as I'm concerned, South East Water are not doing enough. Whitstable is full of small independent businesses. And we have all been affected, and it's just so unfair.
Okay. Well, listen, we hope that the situation improves. I can tell you that South East Water have told us that they are sincerely sorry to customers for disruption to their water supply and know how frustrating it is, especially in hot weather. We're continuing to ask customers to use water for essential purposes only, for example, drinking, cooking and hygiene. Don't think that hair salon is on that list. But let us
know.
Thank you, Sarah. And as I say, best of luck with turning the taps on today. Let's talk to Professor Jim Hall, a former expert advisor to the National Infrastructure Committee, because, Jim, one of the reasons for the supply issues is the South East Water's infrastructure, in particular its reservoir system. And this is a problem that affects other areas as well. There hasn't been a new reservoir built in England since 1992, since when populations have grown. And it's almost biblically simple, isn't it? You store it in times of plenty for times of scarcity. Why is it so hard to build them?
Well, there are a number of things going on here. You're right. There hasn't been investment in large infrastructure. And in the meantime, demand for water has gone up. We're seeing the effects of climate change and the possible risks of increased droughts. And if we want the water in rivers and streams to be better, then that means taking less water out of the environment. And so, as you say, building reservoirs is part of what has now been decided needs to be done to address this risk.
Yeah. But when you build a reservoir, it's not a straightforward thing. It's not cheap and it takes a long time. And fields and villages get subsumed by the water. There are planning objections. The government says it's trying to take a grip of this by making them nationally strategic, important infrastructure. Will that make a difference?
Well, you're right. It does take a long time. There are, I would say, three steps to go through when you're building it. First of all, you've got to decide what to do about where the water is going to come from. So there's very careful analysis which goes into what's known as a water resource management plan. And that has to be approved by the regulators, by the Environment Agency and Ofwat. Then you have to go through the planning approval process. So you have to prepare a planning application, get that approved for major infrastructure. The time it takes to do that has gone up from a couple of years to 4.5 years. And then, of course, you have to build it. And these are big projects.
I feel exhausted already, and I think we're probably 10 years in at this stage, aren't we?
The timescales are longer than that. And you're right, the government has tried to speed up this process because the number of years it takes to get through the planning process has gone up dramatically. We had the Planning and Infrastructure Act last year, which brought in a number of reforms. They're trying to fast track applications, limit the amount of judicial review, keep some of the national policies up to date. Right. So there's a lot of focus on the planning.
Let me just ask you one other question, because we're short on time. But are we seeing the fact that we haven't built one for 30 years or so? Are we seeing the kind of weather conditions that is really brutally exposing the vulnerability that we have, having not done that?
What we're seeing now, as you say, is not. It's been extraordinary in terms of the heat for a few days, but not really in terms of the dryness. We had a relatively wet winter. So actually the drought, which would be really impactful, more widespread and more prolonged, hasn't happened yet. But there is a risk that a drought like that will happen at some point.
Okay, Professor Jim Hall, expert advisor to the National Infrastructure Committee and Professor of Climate and Environmental Risks at the University of Oxford. Thank you very much.
22 minutes past seven. An American school district has secured a $27 million settlement with social media companies it accused of causing a mental health crisis. I've been hearing more from our US tech correspondent, Lily Jamali.
Yeah, this is a case that was brought by a school district in Appalachia in the U.S. state of Kentucky, Brethert County School District. Pretty small group of schools, just about six schools, not that many students there. But it's one of many school districts, about 1,200 across the United States, that are suing the social media companies, alleging that these companies design their apps to be addictive to young users. And they were saying that they, as a school district, had to spend money in order to mitigate the impacts on mental health of the kids in their district. They were saying that these kids were dealing with depression and anxiety. Self-harm came up a lot. And so they wanted compensation for the money that they had had to spend in order to deal with this youth mental health crisis that they allege can be laid at the feet of the social media companies, including Instagram-owned Meta.
Yeah, because it is worth underlining, isn't it? The companies haven't admitted that they've done anything wrong.
They haven't admitted that they've done anything wrong. They continue to push back on this claim that their social media apps are designed to be addictive. And in this particular case, they say that they resolve these claims amicably. But they are under fire from a couple of different major players, not just school districts, but also the U.S. states. There's a big bellwether trial set to take place later this summer in August. And it's worth noting that Meta and Google, on behalf of YouTube, both lost a case earlier this year that was brought by an individual, a young woman from California, 20 years old. She lives just about, you know, 2-3 hours from me in Chico, California. She alleged that she suffered mental health harms as a result of the addictive design of these apps. And so that loss, I think, really stung. But it was a $6 million figure, which is not a lot for these companies, but it was more the symbolism of, you know, having lost a case that they were vowing to fight to the bitter end.
Lily Jamali in San Francisco. Thank you. And that brings us to 25 past seven to the sport. Here's Mike.
Justin, thank you. Countdown to kickoff in the Champions League final. Arsenal taking on Paris Saint-Germain in Budapest later. Knowing a win, we'll see them crowned European champions for the very first time. We heard from Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta in the news earlier. Let's hear from the PSG boss. Here is Luis Enrique.
I think we deserve to win the last Champions League. We were, for me, the best or the better team. It's powerful, but you know how powerful it is try to win the second Champions League in a row. It's bigger.
Don't get caught out by the early kickoff in Hungary. It gets underway, the Champions League final, at 5 p.m. A lot of talk this week about fans having to pay to watch the Champions League final for the very first time. Important to say, it is free to air here on the BBC on 5 Live and on BBC Sounds. You can also watch it on BBC Television, the highlights straight after the trophy lift on BBC One. Elsewhere, Novak Djokovic's wait for a 25th Grand Slam singles title goes on. The Brazilian teenager João Fonseca produced a stunning fight back yesterday to win a 5-set epic in the third round of the French Open in Paris. Day 7 of Roland Garros getting underway later. You can also follow that on BBC Sounds. Meanwhile, the sun will be shining on Rugby League's big day out at Wembley later because it is Challenge Cup final day. Wigan Warriors take on Hull KR in a repeat of the men's final later this afternoon. Before that, it is the women's final. Well, I've been speaking to Chris Radzinski, the CEO of Wigan Warriors, and I started by previewing the women's Challenge Cup final between his side Wigan and St Helens.
The rivalry between Wigan and St Helens is, you know, well written about in the men's game, but it's now developing a healthy relationship in the women's game as well. So they are elite performing teams. We did a real job on them last year at Wembley. I think St Helens will be coming better prepared this year to face our outstanding women, and it should be an absolute cracker.
As you say, the women's game is continuing to grow. A record crowd of over 5,000 for that Super League grand final last season. What can be done to continue this growth of Women's Rugby League?
I think we just continue supporting it, invested in infrastructure behind. You know, it's not just about players. It's about putting systems and coaches and medical and structures in behind the team that give them a real chance of growing. You know, we've invested heavily over the last 2 or 3 years, and at first we didn't see much progress, but once you trust the process and you invest a lot of time and a lot of energy into the infrastructure behind it, then it's only going to grow. As you mentioned, we had 5,000 at the stadium for a standalone fixture. You know, we've never done that before, which is opening the stadium with, you know, just for the women's game. So I think it helps that our team's certainly playing an attractive brand of rugby league, and it's they're winning a lot of fans, and they're inspiring young girls in the town to play rugby league as well. So, you know, these are not quick fixes. You have to put things in place that's going to be sustainable over a fair period of time.
And as for the men, Wigan Warriors, by most measures, are the Challenge Cup kings, aren't you? Won the trophy a record 21 times and been in 33 Challenge Cup finals. But, crucially, later today, you're against the current holders, Hull KR.
Yeah, Hull KR have gone on a real journey as a club, on and off the field. And, you know, they developed into a powerhouse. We did the Grand Slam in 24 and they did the Grand Slam in 25. And, you know, they're the current world champions. So, as you mentioned, we've got a rich history in the Challenge Cup, but we probably go into this game as the underdogs, really, because we're up against a team who have performed so well in recent years. It's going to be an arm wrestle game, and it's going to probably take a little bit of magic for one of the players to unlock the defences. There really is not much in the teams.
27 degrees in Wembley. Later, Chris, have you got the sun cream at both teams ready for the heat, do you think?
Well, yeah, listen, it's going to be a factor. There's no doubt about it. Best players who play in the biggest occasions are the fittest. Our sport is a demanding sport, and what you find is once fatigue kicks in, that's when errors come, that's where gaps start in appearing, and that's where the biggest players come out to play. So no doubt the lads are going to have to be hydrated, and the heat and the bowl in Wembley Stadium actually catches the heat and you can feel it. So it's going to be a factor, no doubt about that. It's really important you do celebrate these occasions because they don't come on very often.
Yes, definitely take the sun cream. If you're heading down to Wembley later, it is going to be a hot one. That is Chris Radlinski, CEO of Wigan Warriors, speaking to me a little earlier. And if you're not heading down to Wembley, you can watch both finals on BBC television today. The women's final is off at 11:15. That's on BBC Two, followed by the men's final on BBC One at 2 p.m.
Mike, thank you. Now, we can turn to Simon Jack to tell us what's happening in tomorrow's Broadcasting House, because he is presenting it as well as this. So I almost said Morning Simon, but
it's yeah, a bit weird.
We've been sitting next to each other for half an hour, if not longer.
So we'll have all the breaking news, of course, in the morning, along with that dramatic explosion. Did you saw those incredible pictures of the Blue Horizon rocket exploding
yes.
on the thing?
It was a malfunction.
It was a malfunction, an anomaly it was called.
Anomaly.
A reminder of the risks of going to space. So we'll have a look at some of the rewards, because we've got the countdown, of course, to perhaps the biggest stock market event in history, the SpaceX IPO. We'll have a look at that. We immerse ourselves in David Bowie at a light and sound journey through his many different guises and genres, and we'll have the paper reviews, of course, with the Sundays in the company of best-selling historian and former war reporter Damon Lewis, outgoing director of the Tate Art Galleries, and Maria Balshaw, and the TV legend and regular visitor Janet Ellis. That's all tomorrow on BH at 9 o'clock.
There you go. The time now is 7:30. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Broadcasting House's Simon Jack and Justin Webb and Chris Aldridge with the news.
Court documents reveal that for the past 6 years, Buckingham Palace had emails belonging to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, which revealed he shared confidential government information. The archive of around 30,000 emails was taken from the account of a businessman, Jonathan Rowland, who travelled with the former prince during his time as a trade envoy. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied any wrongdoing. President Trump has held a meeting to make what he said would be a final determination on whether to agree a deal with Iran to extend their current ceasefire, but there's been no announcement. A White House official said the president would only make a deal that was good for America. A senior Iranian official has said an agreement is close, but not yet approved. Social media companies, including Instagram's owner Meta, have agreed to pay an American school district a total of $27 million, or £20 million, to settle a claim that their platforms contributed to a student mental health crisis. Brevard County in Kentucky is among more than 1,000 school districts across the U.S. that have brought similar legal cases. The companies deny the allegations. The Attorney General, Lord Hermer, has told the BBC he had no doubt about referring the sentences of three teenage boys related to the rapes of two girls to the Court of Appeal. A judge's decision to spare the boys custody and give them youth rehabilitation orders was heavily criticised by the victims and senior politicians. Three judges at the Court of Appeal will now review that ruling. President Trump has said he'll give Congress full control and ownership of the Kennedy Arts Center in Washington, D.C. A federal judge ruled that the institution's board, chaired by Mr. Trump, overstepped its statutory bounds when it renamed it the Trump Kennedy Center. The judge said that Congress had given the center its name and only Congress could change it. Mr. Trump said the judge would rather see the institution die than see him transform it into something that everyone could be proud of.
Thank you. That 27 minutes to 8 is the time. The plan to launch a health facility in Kenya for Americans who may have been exposed to the Ebola virus has received pretty widespread criticism from both Kenyan doctors and apparently as well from US officials working at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And it has now been blocked by a Kenyan court. Let's talk first to Barbara Plett-Usher, our Africa correspondent, who joins us from Nairobi. Tell us first, Barbara, about what the plan was.
The plan was to set up a quarantine center in an Air Force base in central Kenya for Americans who had been exposed to the Ebola virus. Presumably, these would have largely been health workers who are being sent to the Democratic Republic of Congo to deal with the outbreak there. So if they had been exposed, they would be sent to this center where they would be monitored. And then if they showed signs of infection and needed further treatment, they would be sent to a third country, not clear where, but possibly Europe. And so this is a change in policy, frankly, because during the massive Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014, Americans who were exposed to the virus were brought back to the U.S. for treatment in 13 specialized centers for infectious diseases. And the American argument now, or the argument of the Trump administration, is that they want to use Kenya because it's close by. The airports in the region have limited capability. They want to make sure that Americans can be treated in a timely manner. But they also make no secret of the fact that their main goal is to protect Americans at home. American safety is priority, and they're pretty clear they're barring any entrance of the exposed individuals into the U.S.
And what did the Kenyan government make of it?
So the Kenyan government hasn't actually confirmed that this plan is on the books, although it has talked around it a lot. Officials have been talking about their preparedness to deal with Ebola, laying it out in detail, in fact. They've talked about their need to have a role in the regional and global response. They can't abandon their duties. They want the Kenya to be a hub for the UN and international response, and that they're going to be following any local laws when it comes to foreign partners. But they have been taken to court by a government watchdog with concerns because they say this is happening without any transparency at all. We don't know what the agreement is. It's bringing the virus into the country when we don't have it. We don't know what the safety protocols are. We don't know what risks there are to the local population. So actually the court case is asking for information, but there has been a backlash. Otherwise, the medical union here has been saying, this could put the lives of citizens at risk. If it's too dangerous for Americans, it's too dangerous for Kenya. You know, frankly, if you have a high security quarantine center in an Air Force base, the chances of the virus spreading are probably pretty low. But the perception, if you talk to people on the street, is that basically President Trump wants to save Americans and put local people at risk. And so they're very angry about that.
OK, well, Barbara, thank you for that. And let us turn to the view of the union, because Davji Atella is on the line, who's a pharmacist, chair of the Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
What do you make of A, the plan, and B, the court's decision to block it at least temporarily?
I think as a union, we welcome the decision of the court to block the implementation of the quarantine temporarily, because we were asking the information regarding the entire plan. It was very clear that government of Kenya was putting this very secretly until when the American declared that they would not allow any Ebola victim to be in their territory, but then they will be quarantined in the country. And the whole conversation has been rather one-sided, where the government is not giving any plans that they have to protect the Kenyan public and the Kenyan health workers during this particular outbreak, but there's only focus on a quarantine that will take care of the Americans. So we as the union are saying that we have had outbreak before, like during the COVID-19, and those who suffered greatly were the healthcare workers and the public. And therefore, there's no way the government would be concentrating on isolation for the Americans while there's no any regard to the public. And secondly, historically there's not been a reported confirmed case of Ebola in the country. And therefore, this we are seeing to be an intentional importation of the disease to the country. Therefore, there has to be really a plan that is robust in protection of the healthcare of the country.
What would you say to someone who might say on behalf of the Kenyan government, I doubt they'd say it publicly, but they might say it privately, look, we've got a relationship with Donald Trump. It's important for Kenya and it's important for the Kenyan people. It might involve better trade relationships, aid, et cetera, in the long term. We don't want to damage that relationship, and so it's worth doing for that.
The relationship that the Kenyan government has with America should be for the beneficial of the public, of the Kenyan public. And therefore, if the Americans are saying that we are doing a containment for this particular disease, as we all know that that in every situation that there is an outbreak, containment is always done from the epicenter, from the point of outbreak. Like in when there was West Africa, Kenya and other African countries were sending experts to that region. But in this case, where because of the relationship that they have, they want to create a quarantine, or which we can categorically say an epicenter in Kenya, the one thing that government must also do, which you've told the minister, you told the government, that they must also put the interests of Kenyans first. That is, what preparations are there when we have an outbreak in the country? We have shortage of healthcare workers across the country. We do not have functional ICUs in the country. We do not have the hospitals with equipment or the drugs. So there is no way we can assume that if there is a case of quarantine for Americans in the central Kenya, then that disease cannot spread out to that particular base. That would be naive of us to think of that. And that's why we keep on saying that there has to be an investment to protect the Kenyans in the outbreak of Ebola.
Yeah, but when it comes to that wider threat from Ebola, and of course it's the threat not just to Kenya but to other African countries as well, how worried are you? How worried are people in your union? How worried are Kenyan doctors that this particular strain, for which, of course, there is no vaccine at the moment, is a real threat to a number of countries and their people?
We are actually very worried, and we are actually giving out a statement on that today, and we are putting it out clearly that the government has to come out and tell us the plans they have for this particular outbreak. In terms of surveillance in the borders, in terms of the plan for the health workforce, the plan for the units to handle the case in case we report an Ebola in the country. Because we come from a time in 2019, 2020, 2020 during the COVID-19, where healthcare workers lost their life because of the lack of the personal protective equipment. Mm. We may actually find ourselves in the similar situations when we become reactionary when a case is reported. Yeah. Okay. The case could be from the...
Davji Atella, very good to talk to you. Thank you for sparing us the time this morning. Davji Atella, who is chair of the Medical Practitioners Union in Kenya.
It is 20 to 8. Technology has become a more and more integral part of sport. You have VAR in football, there's electronic line calling in tennis, Hawkeye in cricket, etc. And there's more advances to come in the World Cup, which starts in less than 2 weeks. The BBC has been given access to FIFA's headquarters in Zurich to look at some of the technology being used in each game. Shiona McCullum reports.
The FIFA World Cup. It's a tournament that's defined generations since 1930, and not just by goals, but by moments that have captivated millions of fans all over the world. But putting the ball in the back of the net isn't just about skill and ability. There's now technology monitoring every kick of the game. And here in Zurich, I've been given access to FIFA's global headquarters to see the tech in action before this summer's competition.
The man in charge of FIFA's research team is Nicholas Evans. He's been paying close attention to the one thing every match needs, the football.
There is a normal football, but this one has a sensor inside which sends information at 500 hertz. So that's 500 times per second, which is 10 times more than what you see on broadcast images.
The sensor is a unit of three different measurement devices, an accelerometer, a magnetometer and a gyroscope. And in the simplest of terms, it can tell us what the ball is doing in a 3D space.
The sensor will track each touch and can help make decisions about potential offsides or things like handballs. It'll also mean that broadcasters can give football fans information like who kicked the ball hardest or what was the fastest goal strike.
You can even see the faintest of touches here. Obviously, if you bounce the ball, you'll see a much bigger touch. And this just gives you an idea of the sensitivity of the ball. Often at times, the images won't be clear enough or will be very difficult to determine whether a player's touched the balls. This is very clear.
Beyond the ball, there's a 3D scanner being deployed. All 1,248 players from the 48 teams in the tournament will step into it and then be turned into an avatar. Their full body composition will come into play to improve the accuracy of the offside's decision-making, meaning it'll be easier for officials and fans to see which body part crossed the line. In charge of FIFA's innovation is Johannes Holzmuller.
Would moments like the Hand of God or the 1966 goal still happen today, given that we've got access to so much more data?
It's a very good question, and we ask this question ourselves as well. I think it will be different because we still have decisions for interpretation. I think the ones that are factual, here now technology can help and say, okay, the ball has crossed the line or not. I mean, a very good one was Frank Lampard. So coming from the German side, since I'm German, of course, it was a very good experience for us. Looking at it from the English side, I would say, oh my God. So it was clear for everyone that the ball has crossed the line, but the referee couldn't have a second chance to see it in a replay.
While most technology being introduced for this summer's tournament is aimed at improving the accuracy of the game, there is one addition that offers fans the chance to see decision-making from another perspective, the referees.
Hey man, what are you doing?
A first for the World Cup this year, the ref cam.
It's basically just mounted on a relatively simple construction or can be attached to the earpiece. It has an additional receiver, so it's not considered to be too cumbersome for the referee to wear.
Obviously, pressure is everything in a World Cup. It means so much to the players, the fans, and those controversial moments have made history in the past. To be able to see that and those exchanges is something kind of really special.
Yeah, absolutely. It's often hard as an outsider to judge what's happened, and this might just help to understand why certain decisions are being made in a certain way.
So if you're not able to travel to the World Cup to support your team, you're still getting closer to the action on the pitch than ever before.
Sheena McCullum reporting. It brings us to just before 7:45. Insomnia could be fueling the rise in cancers among younger people. That is a finding from research presented to the American Society of Clinical Oncology overnight. Scientists from Jefferson Health in New Jersey and a cancer centre in Louisiana as well analysed data from 19 million people. So it's a very big survey, aged 18 to 50. And patients with a proper diagnosis of insomnia were three times more likely to be diagnosed as well with breast cancer during the next 5 years, almost twice the risk of uterine cancer as well. What is going on? Dr. David Garley is a GP, director of the Better Sleep Clinic in Bristol. Good morning. Good morning to you.
Morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. What do you think is going on?
So what the data has really shown is an association between insomnia and the detection of cancers in the early stages. And that's really important. So what the data isn't showing is that insomnia causes cancer. And I think what's behind that association, I think there could be several things. I mean, we are understanding more that part of sleep is to restore and maintain our immune system. And infective agents, various viruses, play a greater role in the development of cancer than we perhaps thought they did. So this could be part of it. But there is more. And actually, when you're not sleeping well, it's quite difficult to live a healthy life. If you're not sleeping well, you tend to have a higher BMI. You don't tend to engage in much exercise. You often take part in more risky behaviours, things like smoking and drinking. So actually, it might be the secondary things that are actually behind the cancers.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, that, isn't it? So this correlation, I mean, it's an important and interesting correlation, but it's not nearly as simple as perhaps it's going to be in headlines.
It's not, and it is important not to overstate this data. Sleep, really interestingly, the more you think about it, the more you worry about it, the less likely it is to happen. So by overstating the data, you do risk actually probably making more insomnia. So if anyone is struggling with their sleep, it's certainly not to say that you're going to get cancer. It's just, but it is interesting data to have access to at this point.
Well, one of the things that concerns people at the moment is cancer among the young, isn't it? Both in the United States and also actually here.
And I mean, I don't know. You think of phones, etc. You think of insomnia amongst the young. Is there at least a correlation there as well?
So I don't think that's really something that you can glean from the data. I mean, one thing that it is worth picking apart is the fact that the data showed diagnosis of cancer, and actually with insomnia is very much linked to health anxieties in a lot of cases. So it could be that actually through having health anxiety that your cancers are diagnosed earlier. Could be that. So there is quite a lot of work to be done on that data still to really pick apart what it really means.
Just final thought about sleep, because a lot of people will be waking from quite a fitful sleep, particularly over the last few days of heat. You have this Better Sleep clinic. The secret is what?
Sleeping in hot weather?
Yeah.
It's pretty universally felt the impact of heat waves on sleep. It's always quite difficult to sleep in hot weather. One of the best things that you can do if you're struggling to sleep, so if you get into bed and it's just not happening, the best thing you can do is just get out of bed, give yourself a break, find something relaxing and distracting to do while you wait for that urge to sleep to come back. And then when it does, get back into bed. And it's also probably going to be a bit cooler at that point as well. So don't try too hard to sleep. That's probably the best advice you could have.
There we are. Fixed it. Dr. David Garley, GP, Director of the Better Sleep Clinic in Bristol. Thank you.
Coming up, the Attorney General says two teen girls raped in Fordingbridge are still fighting for justice. We'll speak to the former Safeguarding Minister, Jess Phillips, about sentencing of young perpetrators. But it is now time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Brian Draper, Associate Lecturer at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity.
Good morning. What do you want to be when you grow up? Remember that question? It was good to dream, or at least to know there were roles to play when the game of life got serious and we needed to go out and find a job. Things change, of course. I don't expect any of us dreamed of being, and I quote, lower value human capital, which is how the boss of Standard Chartered recently described thousands of staff he was going to make redundant. At what point does one shift from being a child, fearfully and wonderfully made, as the psalmist puts it, into lower value human capital? Our kids, I'm sure, didn't dream either of growing up to be a NEET, someone not in education, employment or training. But Alan Milburn's major report this week reveals that a million or so young people between 16 and 24 are now just that. We have one at home. Our son left uni with a great degree and has spent a year applying daily for jobs, internships and work experience, frequently, though not always, without response. What do you want to be when you grow up? Seen would be a start. To paraphrase the Bible, AI scans the CV, but God looks at the heart. At least NEETs are being noticed now through Milburn's report. Not that there's an instant fix, and I've noticed personally that most people with advice draw from a different world anyway, their world, the one they grew up in, where you could walk into any Saturday job, or knock bravely on a door with a CV, or just do anything to earn some money for now, as I've heard it said to my son. It can be soul-destroying, which is why I'm glad the report calls this a moral crisis. And if this is a lost generation, then haven't we all some searching to do? Maybe it starts, if nothing else, with doing our bit to recover the intrinsic, inestimable worth of each other. When they were small, my kids instinctively loved the parable of the lost sheep from a book of children's Bible stories by Nick Butterworth. Is it in the hen house? No. Is it behind the haystack? No. All day the farmer looks. He is tired and hungry, but he will not give up. Just one soul is precious beyond worth, let alone a million young ones. I do so value Charlie Mackus's poignant line too, from The Boy, The Fox, The Mole and The Horse, which reminds us we can always dream differently. It's painfully childlike, but an encouragement to each of us, like the farmer, never to give up on each other. What do you want to be when you grow up? Asks the mole. Kind, says the boy.
And that was Thought for the Day with Brian Draper. It brings us to 8:09.
The case of the teenage boys who were not given custodial sentences for multiple rape counts provoked profound distress on the part of the victims and widespread anger that the law had got this one badly wrong. The non-custodial sentences have been referred to the Court of Appeal. That was the decision of the Attorney General, who's been speaking to Nick Robinson, and he told Nick this was not a difficult decision.
When I looked at the evidence and the details in this case, they confirmed my initial reaction.
And a reaction of what? Horror? Shock? Surprise?
Well, I want to be a little careful because the matter is now going to the Court of Appeal and independent judges will exercise their own view on it. But I was in no doubt that it was a sentence that I felt had to be referred to the Court of Appeal. I should also say, Nick, I mean, as part of my consideration of the case, I read the victim statements. The bravery of those girls, both putting themselves through the ordeal of a trial, but what is more, when they got those sentences, to carry on campaigning to secure justice.
Well, Lord Hermer was also asked for his message to young women and girls who might be thinking if there is any point in reporting assaults.
You can be reassured that you come forward with your complaints. They will be taken very seriously, dealt with very sensitively by the police, by the Crown Prosecution Service, by the courts. And you'll have the backing of a government that wants to absolutely ensure that we are tackling this epidemic of violence against women and girls.
Well, the Guardian newspaper is reporting there have been three other separate cases of teenagers not being given custodial sentences. So is there a more widespread problem here that require the sentencing guidelines themselves to be reviewed? Jess Phillips, Labour MP, former Minister for Safeguarding and Violence Against Women and Girls, is on the line. Good morning to you, Jess Phillips. Because this is the interesting point, isn't it? You may get a dud sentencing decision where the guidelines are misapplied. If you have more than that, maybe the guidelines themselves are at fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, I think that looking at the sentencing guidelines in these cases, what we have seen over the last number of years, about the last 5 years, is frankly a growing trend of children sexually abusing other children. Over 53% of child sexual abuse, where we know the age of the perpetrator, is perpetrated by somebody aged 10 to 17, the average age being 14. Mm. And I have to say, I don't think that the sentencing guidelines have been updated with that in mind, but more so that actually the prevention that could be put in place, early intervention, whether at school or through the youth justice system, has kept pace with that changing trend, and those things absolutely need to be looked at.
Yeah, because we should say the Sentencing Council for England Wales says that even in very serious cases, courts are expected to use custody as a last resort. Mm-hmm. That needs to be looked at, you say?
Look, I think that when you balance, and if we look at the findings in the Southport inquiry, obviously a terrible and heinous crime committed by a child, one of the main findings of the first bit of the inquiry is that where we focus too heavily on the perpetrator and their vulnerabilities and don't think about the public safety element, we are essentially asking the girls in Fordingbridge and now these new cases that have been reported in The Guardian to essentially sort of suck it up for the sake of, the perception of what is best for the perpetrators. I think absolutely this all needs looking at. We need to really, really focus on what we should be doing to prevent young people. And there needs to be education programmes and youth justice programmes that have early intervention. Because this morning as well, reporting in The Times showing that in the Fordingbridge case, the suggestion of prior abuses, that seems like there is always, in cases that I have handled, opportunities to intervene early that are currently being missed.
What's changed? If the guidelines do need updating, what is it about behaviour or society or the influences that younger men in particular are exposed to that's changed?
Look, it would be conjecture for me to say, but as somebody who has been around many of these cases, and part of the problem is that not enough research has been done. And whilst I was in government, I was setting about starting to do the research on what actually works. But the fundamental, you cannot ignore that this growing trend of young people committing sexual abuse and making up so many of the numbers, I cannot ignore the growth in online pornography. pornography, access to the most heinous things online for this generation that just simply didn't exist in prior generations. And so looking at what young people look at online, what they have available to them, and actually whether crime has become content for an eyeball economy, because in some of these cases, they were being filmed in order to make content.
Right, yeah. Jess Phillips, former Minister for Safeguarding and Violence Against Women and Girls, thank you for that. And a government spokesman, I should say, said sentencing decisions are made by independent judges in line with sentencing guidelines. We're clear that punishments must fit the severity of the crime and custody should always be considered for serious offences.
A couple of minutes before 8 tonight, Radio 4 remembers a sporting great 10 years after his death.
Muhammad Ali.
If you think the world was surprised when Nixon resigned, wait till I whip Foreman's behind.
The iconic boxer and his legendary words.
I am the greatest. I'm pretty. I can't lose.
A remarkable life told by the man himself.
But I just had to let you know that there are more sides to Muhammad Ali than that you see on TV.
And a lot of things I want to do for my people as Americans, the black people of the world.
The Louisville Lip on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Surprise, yeah?
Tonight at 8.
Let us get a look at the weather. Elizabeth Rossini is the BBC Weather Centre. Morning for you, Elizabeth.
Good morning, thank you. Well, the heatwave might be over, but it's still very warm today across the south of England, in particular England and Wales, seeing a dry and a fine day for the most part, but there is rain further north and west. So let's start in western Scotland. Cloudy with outbreaks of showery rain, rumble or two of thunder later. Across eastern Scotland, though, it's dry with some sunny spells, but the cloud will thicken into the afternoon and there will be some spells of rain pushing eastwards later. For Northern Ireland, it's already cloudy. We've got outbreaks of rain in the west, and then after the front pushes through, sunny spells and showers for much of the afternoon. But let's come further south across Wales, Northern England, Southwest England, and also the Midlands and Southeast England. It's dry, it's fine, and it's sunny. The small chance of one or two isolated showers breaking out, light to gentle southwesterly winds, and across the far northwest of England and North Wales, I think we will see more cloud develop later on through the day, and eventually we'll get some showers here. It's warm today, particularly across central, southern, eastern England. Highs here of 27, 28 degrees Celsius, elsewhere 19 to 23 degrees, cooler under the rain in the north and the west.
Elizabeth, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 30th of May. The headlines this morning: President Trump has met officials in the White House to make what he said would be a final decision on a deal with Iran, but no announcement has been made. Court documents say that Buckingham Palace was handed emails 6 years ago that showed Andrew Mountbatten Windsor shared confidential government information while he was a trade envoy. And social media companies have paid millions to an American school district to settle claims that their platforms fueled a mental health crisis among students.
Also in the next hour, we'll hear from the dad campaigning for awareness around B12 deficiency following the suicide of his daughter.
The argument's there, the science is there. That isn't the problem. And I hopefully at some point there'll be a real change.
And
we are faced with a succession of two aggressive storms.
Are you absolutely certain?
D-Day will be calm and sunny.
I couldn't disagree with that more.
We'll speak to the playwright David Haig, whose story of the weather forecasting behind the D-Day landings has been turned into a film.
Good morning from Mike Williams with your Saturday Sport. Can the champions of England become champions of Europe? Arsenal have the chance to secure a rare double later when they take on Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League final. Coming up, we will preview the big match in Budapest with the former Arsenal goalkeeper David Seaman.
Thank you, Mike. The BBC News this morning is read by Chris Aldridge.
President Trump has held a meeting to make what he said would be a final determination on whether to agree a deal with Iran to extend their current ceasefire. It's not yet clear if anything was decided. A White House official said the president would only make a deal that was good for America. A senior Iranian official has said an agreement is close but not yet approved. From Washington, our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
In a social media post, Mr. Trump has again said Iran must never have a nuclear weapon and that its stocks of enriched uranium must be handed over and destroyed. He said only the US had the technical ability to facilitate that. He insisted the Strait of Hormuz must be safely reopened to international shipping. He said the US naval blockade in the strait will now be lifted. Ships trapped there for weeks would be, in his words, heading home. Was this a promise to lift the US blockade without an agreement with Iran? It's not clear. Iranian state media has quoted sources saying President Trump's comments are a mixture of truth and falsehood, an attempt to portray a fabricated victory. The country's foreign affairs spokesman said negotiations were focused on ending the war, not resolving the nuclear issues.
According to court documents, emails which showed Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor sharing confidential government information were given to Buckingham Palace 6 years ago. They were among an archive of 30,000 emails taken from the account of the businessman Jonathan Rowland, who travelled with the former prince when he was an official trade envoy. Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor is under investigation by police on suspicion of misconduct in public office relating to the alleged sharing of confidential material. He's consistently denied wrongdoing, as Ben King reports.
The archive of messages from the then Prince Andrew was taken from Jonathan Rowland's personal email account in 2013 and passed to a retail entrepreneur, Kevin Stanford. Documents from a court case about the archive reveal that Mr. Stanford passed it to a senior palace official in 2020. Mr. Rowland earlier told the BBC that an email from Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor about Iceland was among those taken from his account and subject to legal proceedings. The prince, as trade envoy, requested a confidential briefing from the Treasury on negotiations with the Icelandic government and passed it to Mr. Rowland, suggesting he considered the information before he made his move. The palace said it couldn't comment on an ongoing police inquiry.
Social media companies, including Instagram's owner Meta, have agreed to pay an American school district a total of $27 million, or £20 million, to settle a claim that their platforms contributed to a student mental health crisis. Breathitt County in Kentucky is among more than 1,000 school districts across the US that have brought similar legal cases. Here's our North America technology correspondent, Lily Jamali.
Kentucky's Breathitt County School District had been poised to be the first school district to seek compensation from Meta at trial. Sources familiar with the deal, which was announced last week, say Meta paid $9 million to settle the case. They were the last company planning to contest the school district's allegations that social media apps created a mental health crisis. Breathitt County School District had sued for a total of $60 million from not just Meta, but TikTok, Snap, and YouTube. After settling the cases, it will get just under half that. The companies have denied the allegations and say they take steps to keep young users safe. Meta, Snap, and YouTube said they had resolved the claims amicably. Lawyers for Breathitt County say they will now pursue similar cases brought by 1,200 other school districts across the U.S.
The Attorney General, Lord Hermer, has told BBC News he had no doubt about referring the sentences of three teenage boys related to the rapes of two girls to the Court of Appeal. A judge's decision to spare the boys custody and give them youth rehabilitation orders was heavily criticised by the victims and senior politicians. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
The attacks happened in Hampshire in November 2024 and January 2025. Two girls, then aged 15 and 14, were raped by two 14-year-old boys. A third boy, then 13, was also convicted for his involvement in the second attack. Lord Hermer, the government's most senior law officer and a close political ally of Sir Keir Starmer, told Nick Robinson's Political Thinking podcast that he had no doubt about referring the case.
The bravery of those girls, both putting themselves through the ordeal of a trial, but what is more, when they got those sentences, to carry on campaigning to secure justice.
Both of the girls have spoken anonymously to the BBC. One said the judge's decision was like a rock straight in her face. Sentencing guidelines say the rehabilitation of children should be prioritised. The judge in the trial had said he wanted to avoid criminalising children unnecessarily. In the coming months, three senior judges at the Court of Appeal will review that decision.
Scientists have carried out a large-scale international trial of a DNA test that can distinguish between breast cancer patients who need chemotherapy and those who do not. The results suggest millions of women could safely avoid chemotherapy, sparing them its toxic side effects. Findings will be presented at the American Society of Clinical Oncology's annual meeting in Chicago later today. Bernadette Keogh reports.
This study, led by University College London, followed more than 4,000 newly diagnosed patients over the age of 40 in the UK, Norway, Sweden, Australia, New Zealand and Thailand. The activity of genes involved in breast cancer growth was tested. It found that those with a low score, more than two-thirds of participants, could be treated safely with hormone therapy alone. Chemotherapy is regularly offered to people with early-stage breast cancer that has spread to the nearby lymph nodes, but it comes with significant side effects, and clinicians are concerned it offers little benefit to those with the most common hormone-sensitive type of breast cancer.
The UK boss of the airline Wizz Air has advised holidaymakers to arrive 3 hours before flights home from European destinations because of lengthy queues caused by new border checks. The entry-exit system requires travellers from outside the EU to register biometric information when entering many European countries, which then has to be verified when they leave. A European Commission spokesman said the system was working well at almost all borders. But Wizz Air's chief executive, Yvonne Moynihan, told BBC News that passengers should prepare for long waits.
Be conscious that there may be delays, and just to ensure that you have the proper supplies with you. It's also hoped that the airports, of course, will bring in that extra resilience and extra resource over the summer so that the kiosks are properly working and that people can be ushered to the passport control desks as well, if necessary.
A judge in the US has ordered that President Trump's name be removed from the Kennedy Arts Center in Washington, blocking his attempt to rebrand it as the Trump Kennedy Center. The judge ruled that the change could only be made with congressional approval. Mr. Trump said control of the center would now be transferred to Congress, which could decide what to do with it. BBC News has been told that the broadcaster TNT Sports has not replied to a letter sent by the Prime Minister a week ago asking it to make the Champions League final free to air. This afternoon's match between Arsenal and PSG will be the first time since the Champions League was launched in 1992 that supporters have had to pay to watch the final. Arsenal fans have travelled in their thousands to Budapest for the game, which will also be screened at a sold-out Emirates Stadium at home in North London. Here's our football correspondent, John Murray.
It's here in Budapest, once a capital of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, that Arsenal can underline their status as one of football's newest powers. Only 6 days after lifting the Premier League trophy for the first time for 22 years, now they have the chance to win the most famous and coveted piece of silverware in European club football for the first time. Standing in their way, though, by common consent, the best team in Europe right now, Luis Enrique's Paris Saint-Germain, who won the Champions League themselves for the first time a year ago. If Arsenal do it, Mikel Arteta's team will have achieved greatness, and it would complete an unprecedented clean sweep by English clubs of all three European trophies in the same season.
John Murray reporting.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. What Donald Trump says he wants from Iran is clear. Here he is on Truth Social. Iran must agree that they will never have a nuclear weapon or bomb. The Hormuz Strait must be immediately open. No tolls for unrestricted shipping traffic in both directions. Iran's news agency described the president's statement as a mix of lies and truths. Neither side is yet saying there is any kind of deal on extending the ceasefire, and that ceasefire is itself not exactly watertight. Bloomberg are reporting this morning that an Iranian ballistic missile attack on a Kuwaiti airbase in the last day or so caused minor injuries to some Americans when the missile was intercepted and destroyed, but falling debris struck the base. Speaking in Singapore overnight, the US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said the president was patient in the pursuit of a deal.
We were in a cabinet meeting just a couple of days ago, and the president said, hey, it will be a great deal. And if Iran doesn't want to make a great deal that ensures they don't get a nuclear weapon, they can deal with the guy on my left. That was the only time I've ever been accused of being on the left. And he was pointing at the War Department. And we're serious about that. Our ability to recommence if necessary is, we are more than capable. Our stockpiles are more than suited for that.
Let's talk to Jeremy Byrne first, our international editor, who's on the line. And actually pick up on what Pete Hegseth was saying there, Jeremy. We're more than capable of going back to war. And I suppose the question is, really?
Well, they've got weapons, though their stockpiles have been depleted. There's evidence of that. And, of course, they've kept their forces in place in the area. However, the question is whether simply bashing Iran more is going to get the results that they want in terms of the deal that he was talking about, particularly involving the nuclear issue, because there are some very hard-headed people on the other side, on the Iranian side, who believe they are in an existential fight and they are not minded to give America concessions. And if they make concessions themselves, they want something in return. And hawks in the United States are very opposed to a deal that makes concessions to Iran and leaves the regime stronger or in the possession of billions of dollars of unfrozen assets.
Is there anything behind the scenes? Is there anything that you could describe as trust on both sides? Because there is meant to be a process taking part, isn't it, taking place that the Pakistan government has been involved in, et cetera, that somehow brings this to an end. But, I mean, is there? Can you say that that process is built on anything other than people just saying things in public about each other and nothing more than that?
Well, it looks as if President Trump's optimistic statements about a deal last weekend, once again, are either, I don't know, wishful thinking, some kind of a gambit, perhaps another attempt to calm or move the markets for political or indeed economic reasons. I think that the Iranians simply do not trust the Americans, and they have evidence for that, because Trump pulled the U.S. out of the 2015 nuclear deal when Iran was in compliance, and that deal took a couple of years to negotiate. Then twice, last June and in February, the United States attacked Iran while negotiations were going on. And there's a piece of essential reading this morning, if you've got access to the Financial Times, by an American-Iranian academic called Vali Nasser. And he makes the point, he's very well connected, and he makes the point strongly that the debate in Tehran is just about what you say, Justin, about this trust issue. And he argues that the regime there fears that a short-term deal is part of an American plan to get them to drop their guard, to hit them again, and that any concessions the Americans have spoken about are simply too good to be true and cannot be trusted. And this is really fundamental stuff, because these really big issues like Strait of Hormuz, which Iran wants to keep control of, that nuclear issue, they are way apart on that. And that is ominous for not just the stability in the Middle East if this conflict continues bubbling along, and it's also, of course, really problematic and consequential for the world economy, and that affects all of us.
Mm. Okay, Jeremy, thank you for that. Let us talk to Professor Mehran Kamrava, who is Professor at Georgetown University in Qatar, Director of the Iranian Studies Unit at the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Can I just pick up on what Jeremy Bowen was just talking about there, this business of the underlying situation? How would you characterize at the moment? We've had these statements from both sides about the other side. How would you characterize what is actually happening insofar as it's possible to know behind the scenes?
It's very difficult to tell exactly what is happening. President Trump views his unpredictability as a source of strength. And I think what we're witnessing is in many ways a page right out of his book, The Art of the Deal. He's delaying on purpose. He's trying to throw the adversary off balance. And he is, I think, a deal seems to be at hand, but apparently the president is trying to squeeze it until the very last minute.
A deal, though, that Donald Trump needs to be able to say is a better deal when it comes to nuclear material than the Obama deal, doesn't he? And that's pretty essential for him politically.
Absolutely. As you know, much of his campaign, both in 2018 and then in 2016 and 2022, were based on the fact that the Obama deal was a disaster, and that he needs to ensure that the United States and the world gets a better deal. I think there is, and the Iranians are aware of that. And one of the things that the Iranians have done is to agree to a relatively long-term suspension, something extending as long as 12 years suspension of enrichment, which will then enable Trump to say this is indeed a better deal.
Yeah. OK, well, that's the pressure on Trump. What about the pressure on whoever is running Iran at the moment? And I suppose to an extent that itself is an open question, isn't it? What can we know about what is going on in Iran, both in terms of security, but also politically?
Well, you know, there's an assumption outside of the country that there's either no leadership or that the leadership is fractured. But in fact, what we see is that the state is functioning quite effectively insofar as the day-to-day running of the country is concerned, insofar as military decisions are concerned, and also political decisions. The big pressure on the folks running the country now is to deliver on sanctions relief, and also in the short term, ability to have access to the assets that have been frozen, Iranian assets, as much as $24 billion. And so the Iranians would like not just sanctions relief, but almost immediate access to some, if not all, of those assets.
But is there a time frame then on that, finally? I mean, so if Trump is delaying things and delaying those things that the Iranians would like, is there a point at which it becomes so difficult for them that they give up?
Well, there are certainly groups within the Iranian state, hardliners, who would like to give up and say, let's resume the fighting. But I think there's a critical core of Iranian policymakers who are aware of the need to deliver economically and deliver immediately. And so there is pressure. Now, the Iranians calculate that their threshold for pain is much higher than the Americans, and that although they need sanctions relief, they can outlast the Americans insofar as the deal is concerned.
Professor Mahran Kamrava, professor at Georgetown University in Qatar, thank you.
It is nearly 20 past eight. Emails showing that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor shared confidential government information were given to Buckingham Palace 6 years ago. They were among an archive of 30,000 emails taken from the account of a businessman who had travelled extensively with the then prince. That archive was then passed to another businessman who passed it on to the palace in 2020. Now, contained in that archive were emails revealing that the then prince, as trade envoy, had requested a confidential briefing from the Treasury on negotiations with the Icelandic government in the aftermath of the financial crisis, and suggested that a business contact of his should wait for that briefing before he made his move, was the form of words in the email. So what does this reveal, and what perhaps should the palace have done if they were in receipt of this information? Rachel Maskell is Labour MP for York Central, and in a moment we'll speak to Ailsa Anderson, former press secretary to Queen Elizabeth. But Rachel Maskell first, if Buckingham Palace had these emails in 2020, what should they have done with them?
Well, it's really clear there are so many threads now which need to be woven together. And of course, this is why I've called for a public inquiry, because sitting on these emails was sitting on really sensitive information. It seems that the former Duke of York, the association of my city at the time, was having these confidential briefings, but also with his business associates, Jonathan Rowlands, who not only his father had taken over the Luxembourg arm of a failed Icelandic bank, but also he providing loans to Sarah Ferguson. So the web grows ever darker, and that's why we've got to address the issue of unaccountable power and also the abuse of power in high office. And that's why I think the system built around the royal household has to be reviewed, and the independent inquiry would be able to not only dig deeper, but also to provide solution as to how we hold a power to account.
OK, we should just say the Buckingham Palace has said there's an ongoing police inquiry concerning Mr. Mountbatten Windsor. It's not possible to provide any comment on these matters. And he himself has continually rejected any wrongdoing in his association with Jeffrey Epstein, and, germane to this argument, denied any personal gain from his role as trade envoy. You say you want a public inquiry, judge-led inquiry. Why isn't a police investigation enough on its own?
Of course, police investigation will look at the criminal matters, but there seems to be so many other matters as well that we need to look in all the threads around the former Duke of York. And whilst the police are looking at misconduct in public life, and it is right that they're in public office and it's right that they do that, there are other elements that we need to draw together. For instance, we know that women were trafficked into our country using MOD bases, using civil airports, and those kind of threads as well need to be woven together. We need to understand how one individual was able to pull the wool over so many people's eyes and to conduct his business in the way that he did. So I do believe that we should have a joint committee of the House of Lords and Commons pulling together to hold the royal household to account, their finances and their affairs.
I should say that some of the allegations you just mentioned about people being trafficked are being looked into and are still the subject of an investigation. Elsa Anderson, former press secretary to Queen Elizabeth, 30,000 emails given to the palace in 2020. From your experience, how plausible is it that that material, which are going to be significant, it's what some of the royal family are up to, could sit within that organisation without greater scrutiny, without greater awareness, without some action?
Well, as you rightly said, I don't know how many of those emails actually were included in or referenced to the former Duke of York. This was after my time at the palace. It does sound absolutely horrendous, and it's just another sort of nail in the coffin with this ongoing investigation. But I think, you know, that the police investigation has to take its course, and the royal household acted very, very promptly by saying that they would cooperate absolutely fully with this police investigation. And as we know from last week, this investigation is opening up. And Thames Valley Police have rightly said, you know, there's a number of aspects of misconduct and they will be looking at all of them. Yeah. They're asking people to come forward.
I suppose the question is what kind of level of curiosity would or should the palace have demonstrated towards this cache of emails? Or would they stuck it in the digital equivalent of the bottom drawer and forgotten about it, because that was the way it worked?
I really wouldn't know. I mean, there's a lot of information that comes into the royal household on a daily basis. As you know, the late Queen used to have a red box which she went through every day apart from Christmas Day. You know, there is a lot of information that comes in, and I think it would be wrong for me to speculate about what or what they did not do.
Yeah. I suppose the palace was in a different mode than it was today. Are we more sensitive about this sort of thing? How did it operate? Or was it a sort of siloed operation where you didn't have a big meeting about what are the collective threats to the palace?
Yeah, what we operated 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago in not only the royal household, but in any institution, including government, may I say, is very different to how we operate today. And, you know, everybody is on a sort of a learning curve. And, you know, when the initial stories broke about the relationship between Jeffrey Epstein and the former Duke of York emerged, that was 2010. And we did not know in 2010 what we know today. So I think, you know, you can only deal with the information you have at the time.
Elsa Anderson, former press secretary to Queen Elizabeth II, and before that, Rachel Maskell. Thank you both. I should just repeat that the Buckingham Palace has said there's an ongoing police inquiry. It's not possible to provide comment on these matters at this time.
Coming up after 8:30, we'll be talking about Sir Tony Blair, who is in our studio, of course, earlier in the week, calling for a debate about Labour's direction. He certainly got that debate. There was a real battle, a battle of the pamphlets. So it'll be like the 18th century here in the studio after 8:30. We'll be discussing pamphleteers with our various guests. But first, 25 past eight, time for the sport. Here's Mike.
Not long to go until the Champions League final in Budapest. The big question, can the champions of England, Arsenal, become champions of Europe for the very first time in their history? So how are Mikel Arteta's team feeling ahead of kickoff?
Great. The preparation has been really, really good, really focused, really positive. We are here because we have earned the right to be here in the manner that we have played and performed in the competition. We're going to have to earn the right to go and win the trophy.
Standing in their way, of course, are the defending champions, Paris Saint-Germain. Let's hear from the Arsenal captain, Martin Odegaard.
Yeah, when I started playing football with my friends, you know, in the little pitch next to my house, I was dreaming of this moment, you know, to win trophies, play this final and of course win it. So that dream has been there, you know, the whole life, and of course now the last few weeks a little bit more.
Another key man for Arsenal will be the England midfielder Bukayo Saka. He knows the challenge ahead against Paris Saint-Germain.
We know the history of the club, and we know that we can write history as players in winning it for the first time. So that already for us is a lot of motivation, I'd say.
Well, David Seaman won three league titles with Arsenal. I spoke to him shortly before he flew off to Budapest for the final and started by asking him for his reflections on those scenes of celebration and jubilation that we've seen from Arsenal fans over the last 10 days.
I've been talking to so many fans that are like saying, you know, they're so happy, but a lot of these fans are like 20, 18, 21. You know, they haven't seen Arsenal win the league. And there's a massive group of people that haven't done that. Now they have. Now every Arsenal fan's seen Arsenal win the league. I mean, that's the biggest point for me, is that when we saw the players celebrating actually getting to the Champions League final, it's because it hasn't happened for a long time. You know, and I think that's where a lot of the happiness and jubilation comes from.
Did you always believe that they would get over the line in the Premier League? They went toe-to-toe with Man City pretty much all season, didn't they? And there were a few nervy moments. But were you confident that Mikel Arteta and this team could do it?
I was confident in Mikel, you know, because I know how much work he puts in, and his staff as well, you know, and then obviously that translates to the lads, you know, because I'm up there almost every week doing my coaching with the under-18s and under-21 goalkeepers, and I see a lot of the stuff that goes on, and trust me, he doesn't leave any stone unturned. You've got a chance. You've got to go for it, because you never know when this next chance might come along. You know, it might be another season, it might be another 10 years or 20 years, you know, so you've just got to go for it. We've got one in the bag already. In a way, that's going to help us relax us so much more, you know, because if we hadn't got the Premier League tucked under our belts, there would have been even more pressure on. There's enough pressure on it now to go and actually try and win it, because the club's never won it, you know, and this would be like one of the best doubles, or if not the best double that you could ever do. You know, winning the Champions League and the Premier League is something that a club's never done, and I don't think it would probably be a long time before we ever get a chance again.
I just wonder, though, David, if winning the title when they did might play into Arsenal's hands here, in the sense that they won it in the penultimate game of the season, as we say, when Man City dropped those points, which gave them 3 or 4 days to celebrate, and we then knew that the title had been won by the final game. I just wonder, had they had to wait till the final day and only won the title on the Sunday, then all of those celebrations would have rolled into Monday and Tuesday. We would have seen all those crowds on the street at the start of this week, and that perhaps might have overshadowed their build-up to the Champions League final. That's not happened, and they've had a clear run, a full week of prep for this one.
Yeah, you're right. You know, and having, you know, those extra days, you know, and then the chance to rest players as well against Palace. People that are carrying knocks can be rested, and I think we saw, what was it, like one or two players played that were from the lineup from the week before.
Who from the players, David, has stood out for you this season, and who will be key later, do you think, against Paris Saint-Germain? Which players have stood out for you?
Well, straight away, I go to David Raya, you know, because he's had a fantastic season again. You know, he's won the Golden Glove. You know, although the Golden Glove for me is a defensive trophy, the chances that he's back for are conceding is minimal. But when he's had to make a save, and he's made some really big saves this season, he's been on form, you know, and he's been ready for it. So he deserves a very special mention. The two centre-halves have been brilliant as well. You know, it's been so important that they stayed away from injury. Then obviously Declan Rice. You know, some of his performances have just been outstanding. You know, and he does a lot of the quiet work, and it's the hard work that people don't see. You know, he's always there on a defensive tackle. He's always up there, you know, to make assists and everything. But he's been fantastic this season.
And is set to have a big summer as well with England at the World Cup. So looking ahead then to the big one, David, you will be there in Budapest later for the Champions League final. It's a tall order, though, isn't it, against the defending champions, Paris Saint-Germain. People are billing this as the best attack against the best defence, but we know this PSG side can put you to the sword.
Yeah, but we also know that they can let goals in as well, you know, as we saw against Bayern, you know, and it's a case of us playing to the best of our abilities, you know, to play to our strengths, get them on a set piece, you know, and do what you're good at. When you're in a game like this, don't play the occasion, play your game. And hopefully that'll be us defending really well, giving them the respect that they deserve, but and then trying to get them on a set piece or something. But as much as I'd like to say like 1-0 to Arsenal, I'd take 10-9.
I think the neutral would as well. That would be incredible drama. So that's the David Seaman prediction, is it? Backs to the wall for 80 minutes and then nick it 1-0 from a set piece late on.
Yeah. Yeah, the old 1-0 to the Arsenal, you know, but it's not about how you play, it's about the result. It got like that at the end of the season. You know, our form wasn't brilliant at the end of the season, but we were churning out these results, and that's what we need to be doing. You know, we need to be doing that later, and, yeah, like I say, any win will do.
Thanks again to David Seaman. Great to have safe hands on the programme. He is out in Budapest for the big final later. Don't forget, it is an earlier kickoff than usual finals, 5 p.m. for Arsenal against Paris Saint-Germain. You can listen to it on BBC Sounds. No paywall on the BBC. Listen to the match for free on Five Live. And I tell you as well, Simon and Justin, who else is out in Budapest? Jim Nocte, formerly of this parish. Big
What's
Arsenal
he doing
fan.
There?
He's a huge Arsenal fan. I think he's doing a little bit of a European road trip. He texted me yesterday. He was in Vienna. He's making his way to Budapest, and he has tickets for the final.
I never knew that. He presented this programme for 50 years, I was going to say, and never revealed his... well, perhaps he didn't. I just didn't notice.
Let's look ahead. After 9 o'clock, it is Saturday Live. Adrian Charles is on the line. What have you got for us, Adrian?
Today we have three exuberantly talented guests. So we've got Tom Fletcher, had more than two decades in an incredibly successful band, McFly, and he's gone on to now, which he says is the greatest achievement of his life, the thing of which he's most proud, is that is writing the music for Paddington the musical. We're also talking to Russell Kane, almost incandescently clever is Russell, brilliant comedian, writer, and soon Shakespearean actor playing Romeo, would you believe? Really good to talk to him. And we have a woman called Bethany Handley, who grew up loving nature, explored it wildly in rural Monmouthshire and thereabouts where she's from. And then her 20s, when she became a wheelchair user, her love of nature only grew, but even at the same time as she raged against the man-made barriers which get in her way. It's inspiring to talk to her. Book is called My Body is a Meadow, which I just think's a beautiful title. We've also got the Inheritance tracks of Katie Razzle, Your Friend and Mine, which are really worth listening to. Amazing stories behind them. And we've got the heartwarming story of the rescue of a baby seal off Selsea Beach. The baby seal was an inflatable baby seal, but precious nonetheless, and very moving it is too, I promise you. That's Saturday Live coming up from 9.
Adrian, thank you for that. It is just come out to 25 to 9. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Simon, Jack, Justin Webb and Chris Aldridge with the news.
President Trump has held a meeting to make what he said would be a final determination on whether to agree a deal with Iran to extend their ceasefire. There's been no announcement. A senior Iranian official has said an agreement is close but not yet approved. Court documents show that for the past 6 years, Buckingham Palace had emails belonging to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor which revealed he shared confidential government information. The archive of around 30,000 emails was taken from the account of a businessman who travelled with the former prince during his time as a trade envoy. Social media companies, including Instagram's owner Meta, have agreed to pay a school district in Kentucky a total of $27 million, or £20 million, to settle a claim that their platforms contributed to a student mental health crisis. The companies deny the allegations. Scientists have carried out a large-scale trial of a DNA test that can distinguish between breast cancer patients who need chemotherapy and those who don't. The results suggest millions of women could safely avoid chemotherapy, sparing them its toxic side effects.
Thank you very much indeed, Chris. Let's have a look at our panel. It's been quite a week. It's been the week of the essay. So Tony Blair kicked things off in this pamphlet war with a 5,700-word effort decrying Labour's lack of vision and policy, saying sorting that out was much more important than changing the personnel at the top. Sir Tony criticised Labour's flagship workers' rights legislation. Above inflation uplifts the minimum wage while calling for the party to abandon its net zero targets, cut welfare and rethink the pension's triple lock. The current Prime Minister has hit back on Substack, saying, well, it's right to have an ideas-based debate. Life is very different than it was back in 1997, and Tony Blair's ideas are a recipe for inequality. Andy Burnham then defended a muscular interventionist state, and the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch had her go by telling Sir Tony Blair not to waste his time trying to convince the Labour government to change course. So what do our panel make of this? We have Tom McTague on the line, editor of The New Statesman, and in the studio with us, Polly Toynbee, Guardian columnist. Welcome to you both. Polly, start with you. Anything of substance or just a lot of noise?
I think there's a lot of substance because we're at a time of change and great agonising going on in the Labour Party. The extraordinary thing that Blair has managed to do is to unite the Labour Party totally. So you have Keir, Burnham, Streeting, all of them on the same page, turning on him, saying he just doesn't understand the modern world. And the tragedy, I think, is that I thought Blair's government was a very good government. He seems to have forgotten all of the best things that they did. You know, a million fewer children in poverty, a million fewer pensioners in poverty, much greater equality, Human Rights Act, Sure Start centres, all of that social stuff he simply ignores. And he wants to cut welfare. He wants to stop the net zero energy project. The things that really are at the heart of what makes a Labour Labour, he is rejecting.
Tom, has he, though, elevated the level of debate about this? Is this a refreshing outbreak of ideas-based debate and pamphleteering?
I think there's an element of truth in that. Blair's essay is certainly substantial. If you go through it, there are some really thought-provoking pieces of analysis that I think a lot of people in the Labour Party do agree with, the kind of the macro level stuff that, you know, there's huge changes going on here, whether it's the sort of rise of China and the two-power world with China and the United States and this impending revolution of AI, which Blair is fixated on. I think people do accept that there is something huge happening here. On the other
wasn't the gist of what he was saying is that the world's a very different place, AI is going to change everything, we can't, you know, we need to be close to the US, this is the way the world is, we have to bend ourselves, just get on with it?
Yes, and I think the criticism actually from the Labour Party that I don't think has really landed, the one that I want to hear from the Labour Party, is that Tony Blair is saying a lot of the things that he's been saying for 20 years, 30 years now, that he can see the future coming, that it is inevitable, that you can't sort of manage it through politics, that it's just something that, like the weather, it just kind of hits you and you just have to accept it. And I think if you look at his relationship with the United States, and with global power, he sort of has the same analysis that he's always had, which it lies at the heart of what, when you read sort of Burnham and Streeting's response, they are saying, actually, I think it's not us that's stuck in the past, that it's you. And I think there is a kind of element in truth in both of what they're saying.
Yeah. There's some people questioning how much Labour was in this idea for a Labour, if you like, quasi-manifesto. Polly Toynbee, what does it mean for the looming sort of leadership fight? Does it frame that in a different way?
I think it demands that they all raise their game in terms of producing a big idea. And it's interesting at the same time as we've had Alan Milburn, who used to be, you know, a close Blair associate, very much dissociating himself from this kind of Blairism, this kind of international, globalised idea of what politics should be, and has produced a remarkable document that could really be the spine and the frame for the next phase of a Labour government, where you put children and young people absolutely at the forefront and try and solve the unemployment problem. But I do think that Blair has damaged himself so badly over Iraq that he can no longer see straight. It's somehow paralysed him. And for him to say we should have wholeheartedly joined in with the Iran adventure when it's turned out to be such a calamity, it is really mysterious and peculiar. I don't think many people would line up behind him on that.
He also, Tom, mentions the small boats, doesn't he, in his essay, Tony Blair, and says it's got to be treated really urgently, but comes up with no more solutions, it seems to me, than either the Conservative government came up with or indeed that this government is coming up with. There is a criticism of him, isn't there, that actually he addresses the things he wants to address, but not in a way that's desperately helpful, really, when it comes to governing, even governing on his terms.
Yeah, I think it's almost sort of vibey in that sense that there is, you know, we need to do this. Yes, we need to tackle migration and we need to remain close to the United States and we need to return to Europe from a position of strength. And you sort of are left with the sense, well, how do we return to Europe with a position of strength? Because that was the other striking thing that I found about that essay, was that the man who really led the charge for a second referendum on Europe, the one who galvanized the campaign to stop Brexit, is saying in this essay that we should forget that. We should forget attempts to return to the European Union. And in fact, his criticism of the European Union is that unless it is too burdensome now on regulation of technology for us to return to it. I mean, again, kind of a remarkable position, a very, very interesting position. And I wonder whether it's a kind of straw in the wind for where things are going.
Was it helpful, do you think, to Andy Burnham, Polly?
No, probably not.
Came up? I mean,
he very rarely wants to be helpful to the Labour Party these days. I mean, what's interesting is that his list of policies are almost exactly the same as the current Tory leadership, which is very surprising. So when he calls himself the radical centre, it is actually pretty much Tory. There's almost nothing there that the Tories wouldn't...
Was he always a Tory, do you think?
Well,
that is the view of Blair, isn't it?
I think you judge him by what he did, and I think his government was very good and did remarkable things and was, you know, socially tremendously progressive and in all kinds of ways, whether it was gay rights or, you know, a whole long list of things, first climate change, all of that. So, no, I think it's he who's changed. And I think, in a sense, he's changed by spending his life with people like Larry Ellison, who is the great funder, AI, great funder of his organisation. And also by the trauma of getting it so badly wrong about Iraq. He hasn't really recovered from that. He has to stay back in that era.
Mm. Well, I wonder if it started something. I wonder whether this will be the new method of communicating.
Yeah, the pamphlets are a good thing. We can all agree on that.
Something to read.
Tom McTague, you certainly can, as a sort of pamphleteer in the modern era.
Oh, we're all for that.
Indeed, I tried my own essay this week, but unfortunately Tony Blair landed his at the same time.
Well, yes, a problem with pamphleteering.
I should just say, Andy Burnham, we've been discussing, is, of course, a candidate in the Makerfield by-election, and you can find a full list of all those vying to be the new MP in that constituency on the BBC News website. Tom McTague, editor of The New Statesman, Polly Toynbee, Guardian columnist. Thank you both.
And that brings us to 16 minutes to nine. Georgina Owen was a 21-year-old university student. She died in 2019 after a sudden decline in her mental health. Last week, an inquest concluded that her suicide followed her experiencing delusional beliefs brought about by a vitamin B12 deficiency that had developed as a direct result of her vegan diet. After her death, Georgina's parents, both of them are healthcare professionals, investigated the effects of B12 deficiency and discovered what they see as gaps in awareness, in testing, in treatment, particularly around its psychiatric symptoms. Further testing confirmed Georgina had likely been deficient at a cellular level, despite actually taking supplements shortly before her death. I've been talking to Georgina's father, Julian.
Georgina, she's our only daughter, our eldest. Just a beautiful girl with such a zest for life and doing the right thing. Very gritty, very determined. She did a thing called Project Trust, where you have to go to one of the Hebridean Islands to be assessed, and then you're allowed to go for a year abroad to one of their programs. And she got placed in a mission unit in South Africa, which was a really tough environment. She was teaching kids, maybe 100 kids, maths in one room. She drove the minibus around the area and just got on with it. She decided she was going to study geography, and that was her plan, to help the planet do the right thing, but also have a comfortable life. She just said, I want a cottage and a garden and a husband and to influence the planet, and hence the decision to have a plant-based diet.
At the inquest into her death, the coroner said it had been preceded by a period of delusional beliefs brought about by a vitamin B12 deficiency developed as a direct result of her vegan diet. And you now have devoted, well, a large part of your life to bringing not only that fact to people's attention, but also the wider questions that there are as a result of it.
That's absolutely right. Our world changed that day. Strangely, it took me back to things I'd learnt at med school. And it didn't take us long to think, hold on, that there's something very strange here. What about the vitamin B12? I've gone part-time and just dedicate so probably a couple of days a week to doing this, raising awareness. I've been able to build this network, which we call Club 12, and we've done some remarkable things already, but there's much more to do.
Before we get to what has to happen in the future, in your view, what is it that you think you now know as a fact?
I know as a fact that a significant proportion of the population are at risk of vitamin B12 deficiency, and this isn't just plant-based diets. I know that we are struggling to diagnose that. We have a very poor sensitivity test that GPs use to measure vitamin B12 in the blood, and that isn't an accurate marker of a person's B12 status. I know that the awareness that isn't an accurate marker is poor, but growing. I know that once we diagnose a deficiency, then the way we treat it isn't perfect and needs improving. Diagnosis and treatment are suboptimal, and actually a lot of the NHS regulatory authorities acknowledge that and want to help to improve that.
Could the testing, if we just take diagnosis first of all, are you suggesting that there is a way in which the testing can be really properly improved?
Yes, there are ways of measuring the function of B12 in the body. So there are things called functional markers, and the most sensitive for B12 is called a methylmalonic acid. And so that can be measured in the blood with a simple blood test. And it has been adapted, that test, in Europe to run national screening programs at €1 per test. So it's not an expensive test.
Do we need to think more about reaching out to those groups who might be at risk? And the obvious one, I suppose, is vegans, is people following a plant-based diet.
I think this isn't about veganism. This is about many medicines we give patients in the modern era reduce your ability to absorb B12. A lot of people take a drug called omeprazole, a proton pump inhibitor, and that stops the acid stomach, and you can't absorb iron or B12 so well. So we have a population that are at risk of micronutrient deficiency. And the B12 is the highlighted one here, but there's a major issue nationally about nutritional status. So I suppose the bigger issue is to bring nutrition back onto people's awareness.
You've done so much work. Do you feel when you talk to those, both inside the medical profession and outside as well, who are in a position to make a difference, that you're persuading them?
I do. I get open doors because the argument's there, the science is there. That isn't the problem. And I hopefully at some point there'll be a real change. My challenge is to get MMA available to general practice. Mm.
Julian Owen, father of Georgina Owen, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
It is very nearly 10 to 9. Now, as any general will tell you, from Harold at Hastings to Julius Caesar to Napoleon, weather matters in battle. And that was certainly true on D-Day, when meteorologist Group Captain James Stagg was a weatherman tasked with advising General Eisenhower on when the conditions would best allow the Allied invasion. Here's Group Captain James Stagg speaking to the BBC about working with General Eisenhower.
It was really difficult to go into that room and see poor General Eisenhower with his head on one side and his just staring, waiting to hear what the forecast would be, because normally we had got accustomed to him being such a bright, sprightly man, going about with a broad grin as if he were almost a gymnastic instructor.
Well, the British weather able to make anyone miserable, it seems. David Haig, actor and playwright, wrote a play called Pressure that is now being turned into a film of the same name that he also co-wrote. And David Haig, this is a wonderful idea, isn't it? Well, what's the weather going to be like? Should I put a coat on or should I attempt an amphibious invasion of Nazi-occupied France? tell us more.
Well, it's wonderful to hear Stagg's mellifluous tones, actually. That recording is a superb recording. And it's a fascinating story. I mean, Stagg had a brusque, abrupt side to him, but he had a steely integrity. And I think Eisenhower trusted that ultimately and believed him when he said these huge storms were going to come in on the 5th of June, 1944. Meanwhile, all the American forecasters who used a different system to interpret weather said that it was going to be a beautiful, sunny day. And ultimately, Eisenhower trusted the right man.
Gosh, that's quite a big call, isn't it? I mean, what are the weather requirements for an invasion of that nature? And how good was forecasting back in the 1940s?
Well, several of the European meteorologists, including Stagg, were beginning to understand the power of the jet stream, which had yet to be proven conclusively. And a lot of American pilots flying west to east early in the war discovered, you know, that their journey was taking a couple of hours less. What was this current? And so they anticipated this family of storms crossing the Atlantic and predicted that it would be one of the worst storms in 100 years. And so it turned out to be. If they had gone ahead, between 80 and 100,000 lives would probably have been lost. The landing craft were archaic, flat-bottomed, and would have gone over. Right. And actually, Stagg's true genius was the following day he went back to his charts and he identified a gap between two of these huge storms and said, the Germans will not assume you're coming tomorrow, but there's a space where the weather will be good enough. Great, but good enough.
This is high-stakes weather forecasting, isn't it? Yeah. Now, of course, I'm just guessing that this is not really about the weather. I mean, Time magazine said of the play, pressure manages an impressive feat of making a movie about the weather feel completely captivating. What's it also about?
It's about faith, uncertainty, the fear of failure, the consequences of this enormous decision. Men doing their job to the utmost of their ability, interpreting science and data to inform military strategy. And the contemporary resonance is really interesting because the choices were made so sagaciously and carefully in the circumstances and are an important, actually, indicator in contemporary military strategy, I believe.
Okay. And when can we see the film?
Well, the film has opened in America. I was in New York 3 days ago for the premiere, and that was very exciting, and I'm delighted to hear that Time magazine liked it. It opened officially in the States yesterday. Mm. It will open in Europe on September the 9th, which is a shrewd move on the part of the Europeans because it's after the World Cup.
Okay. Well, we shall see you at the premiere, no doubt, weather permitting.
Yeah.
David Haig, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It is 6 minutes to nine. A lot of people are losing weight these days and doing it fast via the fat loss jabs. When the weight is gone, assuming it stays off, they are noticing something else, though, as well. People seem to treat them differently, perhaps without meaning to, but it is there. And, of course, the background is that people who are heavier are often attacked for it. The Irish singer CMAT has complained about the abuse she gets online from people who don't like the shape of her body. Abuse slimmer singers are not getting. Let us talk to Jules von Hepp, who's a beauty expert, content creator, author of The Confidence Ritual, and Rose Stokes as well, who's a Guardian writer, who writes a lot about being plus-sized and shamed about it, and also who lost a lot of weight in her 20s. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And Rose, I mentioned the loss of weight because that is the key question, isn't it? Were you aware, once you had lost weight in your 20s, that people treated you differently?
Oh, 100%.
And how? How did it show itself?
Well, everyone just was telling me how beautiful I looked all the time and how great and how almost, I mean, I'm not sure anyone ever said it, actually maybe one person did, but how relieved they were that I had lost the weight and how my life had improved because of it. They were telling me that. And then I mean, obviously, I don't have a sort of sliding doors ability to tell you what my life would have been without it, but I had a lot of professional success. I went on to make a lot of good professional decisions that led me to where I am today. I'm not sure I would have had the confidence to do so had I not, like, been propelled by all of everyone's comments about my weight.
And she's not alone in that, is she, Jules von Hepp? That is just an aspect of particularly the industry that you know so well.
Oh, totally. And so I've been a spray tanner for over 20 years, and that's 20 years looking at naked bodies. And every time somebody got in the tent, however famous or non-famous they would apologize for how they look. How we look has become this quite boring discussion in placing our worth. And actually, what I found in my career is what we look like and the shape and size of our body is the least interesting thing about ourselves.
Did it become worse? Has it become worse during the course of your career, do you think? I mean, I'm thinking of the possible impact of social media and the sort of perfection thing.
I think we've seen peaks and troughs. I think, you know, in the 90s, it was the whole heroin chic aesthetic. And then we had a mass movement in the middle of lockdown where body confidence and bodies, different bodies were celebrated through fashion, through beauty, through all different walks of advertising campaigns. And then now we seem to be regressing into this one size, one shape, one aesthetic.
Do you think things are getting worse, Rose, or better?
Oh, worse, 100% worse. Because now I think you would have thought that the sort of new technology that's come in with these medications would prove to people once and for all that actually thinness isn't something that's necessarily earned by people and that actually there are genetic factors at play. However, it's brought in this sort of new level of stigma, I think, where people now think, well, why don't you just inject it away? Or like, if you don't have a size 8 body, what are you doing? Like you can do something about it now, so you should be. I think that it's made people almost less forgiving, if that was possible.
Does it tell us, do you think, Rose, something though deeply about ourselves that is uncomfortable, which is that actually we do. We subliminally sometimes, but perhaps not subliminally, think of people who are heavier as being lazier, less able, etc., etc. And that's it's almost, it might not be a good thing, but it's always this sort of human characteristic somehow.
Oh, absolutely. And there will always be social hierarchies and people always want to benchmark themselves against each other. And weight is a fairly easy way of doing that. Like, I'm thinner than you, therefore I'm better than you. But the reality is, like, I have regained quite a lot of the weight that I lost. And I go to the gym 5 times a week now, or exercise 5 times a week. I have a friend who's a semi-pro rugby player, and we train the same amount. I eat really well, better than anyone I know, and I am still overweight. And unfortunately, like, one thing that I think we can glean from this new era of medicine is that we can really start believing that this is not necessarily, you know, down to a lack of willpower. And I think we need to take that on. However,
just a final thought from Jews. It's also not your industry. It's not the fashion industry. It's not necessarily. It is something more human than that.
It's social norms. It's just what we have been socially educated to praise one another on our looks. I think.
But is it social norms, Jews, or is it just something more innate than that? That we've just always felt, I wonder.
No, I think it's taught. I don't think it's something that you learn to praise an aesthetic. I think it's something that you learn from a child being praised on how you look. And I think, actually, if you think about the types of compliments you pay throughout today,